Members, we're going to bring the House Environment, Energy, Natural Resource Committee to order. Members, last night, I thought we were done after we had all the agency overviews, but we had some testimony from some citizens. It was getting to be a very late hour, so luckily three of them offered to come in today. So I think we'll hear from them first. Also, Senator Hottinger wanted to testify, and he'll be added to this list of four people. We'll hear them before we start on the wild rice. Is there any other folks that were in the audience last night that did not get to speak, that wanted to speak? Okay, then we'll work. We have Mr. Morris, Mr. Arnasty, Mr. Peterson. I saw him this morning. I believe he might not be in the room now, but we'll have time. And then we'll add Senator John Hottinger to that list. Mr. Morris, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of handouts I'd like to share with the committee, if I could.
Mr. Morris, we're going to have to get somebody here. We'll get Mr. Harris. We'll, or do you want to, if you don't mind, Mr. Morris, just give some, can you just give some to each end? Both pages
Absolutely.
Just ran to make copies for some of the folks didn't have their copies they needed. Apologize. Thank you, Mr. Morris.
After your late night last night, we're all running a little bit behind schedule, I think.
We're all right, Mr. Morris. We'll do just fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify here today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. MEP, as we're known, is a coalition of more than 80 environmental conservation organizations ranging from everything from Minnesota Forestry Association to Trout Unlimited and the Isaac Walton League and everybody in between. We have our membership represents over 500,000 Minnesotans. I'm here today before the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee in the House to talk about the budget. And this is the body that we view as the advocacy body for environment and natural resource funding. And we have some very great concerns about the bill that is before the committee at this time. The bill before you represents severe cuts in general tax support for Minnesota's great outdoors. I'm going to particularly focus on the general fund portion of the budget, which is our general state taxpayer support part of the budget. And today, which is International World Water Day, with activities going on around the world to highlight the importance and dependence of our dependence on clean water, I want to especially focus your attention on how the legislation before you affects the status of Minnesota's lakes, rivers, and streams, our public health, and Minnesotans' great outdoors. Last night, I sat through the testimony, and I heard a fair amount of discussion about priorities. We have to set priorities. Well, let me tell you what Minnesotans' priorities are as it relates to environment and natural resources. Minnesotans care deeply about our resources, and most importantly and overwhelmingly, they care deeply about our water. When asked, consistently, water ranks on top of their priorities in every sector of the state. And that's evidenced by a couple of things. In 2008, you all recall the legacy amendment when it was passed overwhelmingly with 59% of those voting on the question voting to raise their taxes in tough economic times to protect their natural resources, their water, their land, their habitat, and their arts and cultural resources. The number one reason why they voted for that tax increase was to protect their water. One of the handouts that I gave you, if you'll look on one side of it, it shows some numbers from a poll that we did about 2 weeks after the 2008 election, done with a bipartisan national polling firm. We asked people who voted yes, who identified as voting yes to the amendment, what were the reasons for voting yes. And what you'll see is cleaning up and protecting Minnesota's lakes, rivers, and streams overwhelmingly crushed any other issue, way above even the other category as to why people voted yes. Minnesotans care about water. They're willing to pay their taxes and raise their taxes in order to protect and restore our clean water. We continue to poll, and in 2010, our most recent poll shortly after this fall's election, more than 80% of Minnesota voters said they are concerned about toxic chemicals polluting Lake Superior, pollution of our drinking water, pollutants that are released into our food, including our fish, such as mercury, and pollution of the Mississippi River. So that's number one priority for Minnesotans as they think about their environment and natural resources. And as we come to this budget bill, let me tell you, it's also all about the water. This budget bill hits hard at Minnesota's lakes, rivers, and streams, with disproportional cuts to agency budgets that protect our waters. We heard those yesterday, and I'll go into those just a tad bit more. This strikes at the very core of our shared Minnesota values. We in the environment and natural resource arena are willing to do our share to help the state out to balance its budget. But we're not willing to stand quietly by and let our funds be raided. Well, we'll only modestly address the state's budget problems. Let me give you a few examples of the concerns. We talked last night, you heard last night from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, a 64% reduction in general fund dollars. 64% reduction. Now, it's true, overall, the agency has maybe a 2% cut, but the fee revenues are very different purposes, specific fees that are maybe raised for landfill cleanup, for fuel tank cleanup. Those don't make up for the core programs that we're cutting in our water. 100% cut to the Clean Water Partnership Grant and elimination of the program that was passed, as I recall, back in 1988. Senator Jerry Ouellette, which really started local watershed work to identify, do the science, and then do cleanup of water resources. Septic systems, which is a chronic problem around the state, 100% cut of the base fund grants for that. In DNR, the water and eco programs were also singled out for cuts. Particularly the water program in the DNR was cut 29%. This will impact our flood management, our ability to respond to floods and hazardous situations. It will slow down the permitting process just after we went through passage of House File 1, which was intended to speed up the permitting process. We're now cutting the funding to actually do that work and to make it be done in a timely manner, creating a situation where we may not be able to meet the goals of that legislation. And barred water and soil resources, 18% in general fund cuts. These cuts unravel the traditional sources of funding for water. We rely heavily on general fund dollars for water funding. These cuts unfund and unravel the traditional sources of funding for water. The next point I'd like to make is the legacy amendment. Earlier this year, each of you received a letter from a broad coalition of groups and MEP members and other groups. And included not only many of our 80-plus groups, but other groups like Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and other groups, laying out our joint concerns and principles as to how the legacy amendment should be used. And I handed this out to you, so hopefully you all have it. I just want to read one quote from the Constitution that's in this letter. Money under this section must supplement traditional sources of funding. Doesn't say a portion, a slice of traditional sources. It must supplement traditional sources of funding for these purposes and may not be used as a substitute. Let me suggest that the bill before you does not meet the first part of that clause, because what we're doing is we are unraveling the traditional sources of funding for water protection in Minnesota. When we get to the legacy bill, we'll talk about the actual substitution that will occur if the plans laid out go forward. But this, we're not meeting the basic supplement, we are not meeting the traditional sources of funding for these purposes. All of our groups got together shortly after, and this is the coalition that really brought the amendment forward, worked hard together in partnership to pass it. And after it was passed, we said, how do we define what is a traditional level of funding? How do we know when people start to substitute? And we came to three principles that I want to share with you. And those are in the letter on the second page. And the first one is the 1% principle. And basically, we're saying we understand state budgets will rise, they'll fall, and we can't say that we cannot be touched. But what we do believe is fair and reasonable is that we should just take a proportional cut or a proportional increase. So what we said is where we are now, which is the lowest in historic, in the history of recent economic and environmental funding, where we are now is our traditional share. It's actually less than where you've been if you average it over time. And we should keep that percentage. So if the state budget rises, we get a little more. If it falls, we shrink, but we shrink proportionately. That's the 1%, that's the 1% test. And that relates to general fund dollars, and we'll come back to that. The next is statutorily dedicated funds. The various funds that I referenced earlier, like petroleum tank cleanup, the tire fund, or other funds, should not be rated to pay for general fund dollars or to substitute for general fund dollars. That's happened before, and we're saying that would violate these traditional sources. And the third is any capital investments must be maintained at least at the 10-year average of the capital investment, which is 22%. I'd like to thank you for not rating statutorily dedicated funds. I do not see that in the bill. You're respecting what those funds are intended. You're not misusing them for other purposes. But I do want to call your attention to the general fund allocation. The other side of the single pager that I gave you has a chart of the analysis that we've done over, what is this, the last 12 years on the percentage of general fund dollars going to support conservation and environmental programs. And we've tracked the same programs over the last 12 years. This is work that's done by Conservation Minnesota, and we issue a report on at least a couple of years to analyze that. And what you'll see is after the amendment passed, we hovered around that 1% level, which goes back and almost, which is at the same level of 2006. What you see for 12 and 13 is the percentage that we would have if the governor's budget were put into place. So this takes historic documents and then analyzes the governor's budget. And what you'll see is a very steady decline from 2% down to the 1%, and then in the next biennium we actually drop significantly below the 1%. We think the governor failed to meet this test and did not adequately fund environment and natural resources, and we disproportionately took a hit. We think this bill goes much further than that. We haven't had time to fully analyze it, but my rough back of the envelope sketch says that calculation says you might be at half that level. This is something that we cannot abide. We are plunging well below what is a traditional level of funding for our lakes, rivers, and streams, and particularly focusing on our water. Next point I want to make is user fees. In order to abide by the constitutional amendment, MEP and its member groups support traditional user fees to pay important program costs. User fees for specific activities make sense. It doesn't make sense to tax all of us for specific purposes. Let me give you a couple of examples, and the governor has put these forward. Hunter license fee increases to support working with wildlife, such as chronic wasting disease. Increased boat licensure and fishing license fees to address aquatic invasive species, people that use the resource and also create some of the problems. LCCMR, we also raise our concern about the fact that in this legislation, the LCCMR proposals that were put forward by a joint citizen legislative commission, and I served for many hours on the council that put that new structure together, but those recommendations are not abided by. And yes, it's about 20% of the money, as I understand it, that is reallocated for other purposes, but it flies in a direct conflict with the fee issue. We should be raising fees to pay for some of these specific programs because the users pay for them, and not raid the LCCMR, which was passed with the people's intent of it being used for a broad variety of purposes, including research for these purposes. But even more importantly, two other points about the LCCMR. We cannot hire permanent staff with LCCMR dollars, and so when we lose general fund dollars and move them to LCCMR, we are undoing those programs. It's not an even exchange in terms of ability to do programs. And I think everyone should be aware this sets up a dangerous precedent for the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. If we do not respect the citizen legislative process as it relates to the LCCMR, this is a precedent that says we do not need to respect it for other councils. Mr. Chairman, I understand you'd like me to close up. Let me finish with two final categories. I just want to touch on, but I won't go into two policy issues that we're very concerned with at MEP. The wild rice statute, the wild rice standard, actually suspending the standard and moving a technical science-based process into the legislative political process is untenable and will result in a lot of mischief for a long time to come. And the school trust fund lands. In order to protect our million acres of school trust fund lands for the long term, it's economically and financially prudent to follow sound, science-based, natural resource management principles. In closing, let me leave you with these thoughts. Minnesotans value our great outdoors, lakes, rivers, and streams, and natural areas. We believe this is the biggest cut to our great outdoors in Minnesota history. We were at a historic low of 1% of general fund support for these bills. This bill takes us well below that modest share. Make no mistake, this bill does not, as the Constitution says, maintain traditional sources of funding. And it turns a deaf ear to the 1.6 million Minnesotans who voted to raise their taxes in tough economic times in order to address our land, water, resources. This is about defunding our water resources when it should be about protecting our water. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue, as was demonstrated convincingly by the 2008 election. This is a Minnesota value about our future and our natural resources. We came into the session having but a modest 1% of general fund dollars in environment and natural resource areas. Do you really need to zero in on the great outdoors to balance your budgets? We're talking tens of millions of dollars, but we're going to have dramatic long-term impacts. We ask you to abide by the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Constitutional Amendment and protect our water consistent with Minnesota core values. Thank you.
Question.
I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Ernosti. Mr. Ernosti, I'd like you to hold it to 5 minutes. Thank you. I'm sorry, did someone raise their hand? No. Okay. Mr. Ernosti.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good to see you again. My name is Don Ernosti. I'm the policy director with Audubon, Minnesota. Audubon, Minnesota has 13,000 members here in the state, organized in 14 local chapters, and we have membership in every legislative district across the state. We focus our conservation work on birds and their habitats for the benefit of this and future generations. Audubon members understand the state is in tough economic times, and we appreciate that your task is not easy to allocate scarce funds among top priorities. We recognize the value of careful scrutiny of state budgets and applaud your efforts to try to obtain fair return on the conservation dollars invested in state agency budgets and programs. We all have a right to expect excellence in our state government. Yet yesterday, we heard Mr. Kelleher state something which I think bears repeating. He said, and this was late at night, I realize it was tough for everybody to pay attention, but he said, Minnesota did not get into this fiscal situation by overinvesting in conservation, and we're not going to solve this problem by underinvesting in conservation. 20 years ago, Audubon members were at the forefront in proposing, developing, and supporting the Wetland Conservation Act. This landmark conservation policy has been implemented at the local level with state oversight by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. After an initial period of controversy and policy adjustments, 20 years later, we find wetlands formerly described as wastelands, today recognized for the value they provide to society in the form of clean water, wildlife habitat, and groundwater infiltration, to name a few. Yet your budget proposes to unweave the critical funds necessary to support local conservation technical assistance. This was brought out in testimony yesterday. Outreach and support in the form of Bowser funding for natural resource block grants, PCA funding for the Clean Water Partnership are vital to implementing these state conservation policies that have been so successful in protecting our resources. We're talking about a few million dollars in unweaving that state-local conservation partnership. MPCA funds for counties to address leaking septic systems which foul our water with dangerous pathogens are cut. Is this really wise policy? I think we're talking about priorities for the people of the state of Minnesota. 2 years ago, voters in a tough economy voted to raise their taxes to increase investments in clean water, habitat, and parks. Speaking as one of those voters, we didn't do so to endorse a decade-long trend of disinvestment in these areas. This is the chart that you've seen there. We've had this decade-long disinvestment trend. The reason citizens led the effort to put the constitutional amendment on there is we want this to stop. And I think it was overwhelmingly endorsed that we're asking for more, not less, investments. Nor did that vote or the statutory language in the similarly voter-approved Environmental Trust Fund endorse or allow substitution of these funds for regular general fund investments. Mr. Morse just covered that. Cuts to invasive species program funding, both aquatic and terrestrial, and general funding to the Division of Ecological and Water Resources threatened to do just that. Finally, I'd like to address the area of our forests, another broad habitat in our state. And Representative Dill, I think, is quite familiar with what I'm about to say. 20 years ago, there was much controversy over logging and forest management in Minnesota. Many citizens were challenging traditional logging practices and pushing for incorporation of modern science and improved forest practices to assure our forests were sustainably managed for all resources. Several mill expansions were challenged over cumulative effects of increased logging until the state conducted the Generic Environmental Impact Statement on Forestry, the GEIS. This landmark study ultimately resulted in the formation of a tiny body called the Minnesota Forest Resources Council with a budget of less than $1.5 million a year. That's less than 10 cents per forested acre per year. This council was given the responsibility to formulate and oversee what I call the Handbook of Better Forestry. It's called Site Level Guidelines, Minnesota Site Level Forest Guidelines. These voluntary forest management guidelines have revolutionized forest management in this state. Along with the landscape program and other educational research and monitoring efforts, this tiny little agency has been a key link in public acceptance and support for current logging and forest management, which is so vital to tens of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in revenue to companies in our state. Further, these guidelines are vital to the certification of Minnesota's forests, which give the paper industry in our state access to the largest pool of certified timberlands in North America. Cutting back on funding of DNR management, as well as Forest Resource Council funding, which both the governor did, as well as your budget, threatens the progress that we made in modern forest management and the certification which gives our paper industry a worldwide competitive edge. Again, why are we risking these important gains in both social and environmental policy set against tiny savings in the overall budget? Finally, in conclusion, I'd like to say Audubon members support fees for services. We encourage you to look closely at proposals to increase fees to support investments in invasive species and wildlife management as alternatives to some of these funding cuts. In other areas, we recognize the need to invest scarce general fund revenue to sustain an appropriate level of conservation capacity at the state and local level. We believe this is what Minnesotans expect. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. I see no questions. Thank you. I don't see Mr. Peterson in the audience. Next, we're going to hear from Mr. Robertson in regards to wild rice. We'll begin there. Senator Hottinger is going to speak to wild rice after Mr. Robertson. And then if Mr. Peterson comes back in the audience, we'll work him in. He originally was going to speak to just the general budget, but he's not here. Mr. Robertson, if you could come down now. Thank you. Members, we have, as you see on your list, maybe about 10 folks, maybe a dozen, in regards to the wild rice standard. It's our hope that we'll be able to get through all these folks today. If we get towards the end and we're not able to get them, we'll find out who can come back tonight. We're on the docket. I believe it's for 4:30 tonight. 4:30. Mr. Robertson, if you can begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Robertson. I am environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And for the past year, the Chamber has coordinated the industry's review of the sulfate wild rice rule. I've been involved in environmental policy and regulation for a long time. And as I think about the PCA wild rice rule, it's almost as if there's a perfect storm that's been created by the rare combination of circumstances and issues that bring this issue before you today. Very briefly, here are those circumstances. First, we have a standard that was adopted 38 years ago based on information that was gathered in the early 1940s, 70 years ago. Second, the standard has never been reviewed for its basis in science. Third, until last year, the standard has never been applied in a permit. It was addressed in a 1975 permit, but the permit did not impose the standard in the rule. Fourth, the standard is intended to protect wild rice, a valuable natural resource that has a profound religious, cultural, and economic significance for the Native American communities of Minnesota. Fifth, the standard has become an issue as the mining industry seeks to expand in northeastern Minnesota, creating thousands of jobs and pumping billions of dollars into our economy and into our state treasury. Now, I want to comment on the path forward to address this unique set of circumstances in a moment, but first I'd like to correct the impression that some people have that the sulfate wild rice issue only impacts industry, and particularly the mining industry. Now, naturally, most of the public focus on this issue has been in the context of mining. The U.S. Steel Keetac permit issued last June was the first to include the wild rice standard. Other taconite permits will be coming before the PCA soon. And the sulfate wild rice issue has been raised in the PolyMet EIS. But the rule does not only affect the mining industry. Any wastewater treatment facility that discharges sulfates to waters where wild rice is growing may be affected by the rule. And as the Chamber began assessing the rule last year, we prepared a map, and I think you have a copy of that in your packet, showing permit discharge points where wild rice waters may exist. I say may exist because one of the deficiencies of the PCA rule is that it does not designate the waters of the state where the standard applies. We created this map using wild rice information from the DNR. We found that there are 230 industrial facilities and 385 municipal wastewater treatment facilities that could be impacted by the rule. So this rule is not just a mining issue or an issue for private industry. Mr. Chairman, I want to be very clear that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce recognizes the importance and value of wild rice. We support water quality standards to protect wild rice that are based on current science. In December, we asked the PCA to bring interested parties together to develop a science protocol for research that would lead to a new rule to protect wild rice. Also in December, we met with natural resource managers from tribal governments to discuss the rule and to express our desire to work with them to develop a plan for scientific research. We want to thank Governor Dayton and Commissioner Austin for including funding for research in the administration's budget. And we thank you, Mr. Chairman, for including funding in your draft bill. There appears to be a consensus that the state should move forward with a research plan that will provide the science needed to determine the appropriate scientific standard to protect wild rice. But the most difficult issue as this process moves forward is the status of the current rule in the interim period until the wild rice rule is adopted. We appreciate the fact that the PCA wants to move quickly to develop the research protocol. They hope that the research can be completed in 2 years. We think that's an optimistic estimate of the timeline. The research will require seasonal data collection that will be affected by weather patterns and growing conditions. In the meantime, PCA will receive permit applications for new facilities or reissuance of expiring permits. What should permittees be required to do? How can they design and implement treatment technologies when they don't know what the standard will be? In a preliminary review of potential treatment technologies, we found that the capital costs are in the range of $3 to $4 million for a municipal treatment plant to tens of millions up to a couple of hundred million for a large industrial discharger. Those estimates are for meeting the current standard. So the bottom line for us is this. Permittees should not be required to design and implement technologies until a rule is revised after the research. It makes no sense to require huge expenditures of capital when the final standard is unknown. Mr. Chairman, you have addressed this issue in Section 14, Paragraph E of your draft bill. But there is a complication. What will the Environmental Protection Agency say? The EPA approved the water quality standard adopted. The EPA approves the water quality standards that PCA adopts. And they approved the water quality revisions that were adopted by the agency in 1973, which included the sulfate wild rice standard, even though the standard was not required to comply with federal water quality standards. And by the way, there is no other state that has a sulfate wild rice standard. So what will EPA say? Will they approve the permit limitation in Section 14, Paragraph E of the bill? If not, how can the legislature ensure that permittees don't have to build treatment facilities until the new rule is adopted? Should the legislature repeal the existing rule? Should the legislature establish an interim rule? Should the legislature require the PCA to adopt an interim standard? These are all options. At this time, we don't know the answer. As you heard last night from Commissioner Austin, the PCA has begun discussions with EPA Region 5 in Chicago. However, experience tells us that such talks could go on for a long time. We believe that this unique situation, this perfect storm of issues and circumstances, requires attention at the highest levels. We hope that Governor Dayton and Commissioner Austin will take this issue to the highest levels of the EPA headquarters in Washington to find a way for the research and rulemaking to move forward without requiring costly treatment technologies before the new rule is adopted. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, I want to reiterate that the Minnesota Chamber supports water quality standards to protect wild rice that are based on current science. Whatever that standard is, after completion of the research and the rule revision, our members will comply. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Robertson, I really appreciate your testimony with regard to current science and wild rice, and I think many of us are on that same page. What I would like to hear you do is comment on this whole bill that is before us, because it has huge implications for our waters, just as the sulfur does, and particularly about all of the science and the research that is being cut in the LCCMR bill.
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius, I don't have specific comments on the individual LCMR projects. I understand that the legislature is setting its priorities, and that is occurring in this committee and in other committees, and will be occurring on the House and Senate and the conference committee. Clearly, if there are less resources, it's tougher to get the job done, and we understand that, and we know that we will have to deal with that as industry, as business, as permittees. And on the broad question of what the impact will be, we certainly will be looking at how the agency operates with those funds and how it will impact the issuance of permits and the doing of business with good science, as you say.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just sensing a conflict between your testimony about current science with regard to wild rice and stepping up to the plate to protect our waters, when this is part of a bill that says that water is not a priority, and in fact we're going to be doing a lot of cutting to things that protect our waters, on one hand, one thing, and a second section, major section of this bill, saying we no longer want current science to give us guidance in how we should protect our resources. So there are two large sections of this bill that are in conflict with the testimony that you're giving, at least from my perspective, and I want to make sure that I am hearing the Chamber of Commerce correctly.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Roberts,
Representative Wagenius, you are hearing the Chamber say that we believe that the environmental standards of the state need to be based on good science. As I said, this clearly is a perfect storm situation. There isn't any circumstance within the existing standards of the state where we have a standard that was adopted 38 years ago that really hasn't been enforced, based on information that was collected 70 years ago. Very unique situation. I understand the concerns and the about science generally and the ability of the state's budget to deal with that. We are concerned about that. It may develop into situations where we will have permitting conflicts because of science. We have those all the time with the agency. That may be the reason for some of the delays in permitting, because we're arguing about science. That's part of the process. That's part of the complexity of permit making and technology and science, and it's what we have to deal with in whatever the financial circumstances are of the state.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm obviously not articulating my question very well. And my question, I understand your testimony with regard to current science and wild rice, and I accept that, and I agree that we do need to do a new study of wild rice. But in this same bill, there are huge cuts to water programs that may have as much impact on our waters of our state, if not more. And there are research projects that have been cut that would give us guidance to how we manage, for example, our boreal forests. Solid research by probably one of the leading professors in the world cut in this budget. So I just sense a conflict and want to know why the chamber is testifying just on this piece and not the rest of the bill. What I really want to hear you talk about is the rest of the bill and the chamber's position on the rest.
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Robertson,
Wagenius, as I said, I'm not trying to avoid your question, but I think, as I said, I'm just acknowledging generally that there are impacts from these budget cuts, and then those impacts will impact the research that's contained in those projects that will not be funded. I can't give you comments on each one of those projects specifically, but I'm here today because this particular issue is one of the most difficult science questions and will have a very great impact on the economy of the state, and it is a priority, and we think it needs to be funded, and we thank the committee for including it in the budget.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Robertson. I appreciate the map that you put out here. It looks like over 600 discharge locations throughout the state, of which I would expect well over 100, maybe a couple of hundred, are in the wild rice region. I'm not really certain what the number would be, but I thought I heard you say that it was up until last year that there was really a single permit in the state that actually was held to the standard. I think that's what I heard you say. I'm curious, so those, you know, several hundred or a couple hundred anyway, discharge locations, municipal, industrial, and others, is it safe to say then that they were discharging without regard to what the standard was, or how would... do we know what? Do we have any idea what their sulfate discharge levels are at,
Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, there are a lot of permits, dischargers that could be affected, and I don't believe the agency has information on the sulfate discharges from all of those facilities. They are now just beginning to require municipal dischargers to start monitoring. There is some limited information. We know that facilities, some municipal facilities on the Iron Range, have sulfate levels that exceed the standard. This rule has been in place for 37 years. The rules have been reviewed every 3 years as required under federal law, and this sulfate standard has never been addressed, as I said. That one time in 1975, was a permit where the standard of 10 was not finally imposed in the permit. There was a higher standard. So the KTAC permit that was issued last year is the only permit that has been issued thus far that contains the permit, the standard that's in the existing rule.
Follow up, Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I think I heard is that these municipal and industrial facilities are discharging sulfates at rates that they may discharge at, and we really probably don't have a good sense of what where they are. Do we know if are there any reported wild rice kills in that area that have been reported that anybody is aware of? Mr. Robertson, you aware of any?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Robertson.
Representative Drazkowski, people who are more expert than I could talk about the conditions of the naturally growing wild rice in the state over time. I can't comment on that. I don't know of specific instances where anyone is connecting sulfate discharges to the condition, specific conditions of or degrading conditions of wild rice. But the problem has been that there has been very little information. You talked in a previous hearing, there was some discussion about research that may have been going on, and there has been research that has occurred over the past number of years, and we've looked at that research. We can find a range of sulfate levels from 3 up to 3,000 where wild rice is growing. So there's a lot of very significant questions that need to be answered about what is affecting wild rice. Is it sulfates? Is it sulfates in combination with some metals in the sediment? Is it the interaction of the water levels and the sediments and the chemistry? That's why we need toxicity studies. The PCA is working on that. We are heartened that they want to move quickly. They agree with the provisions in the bill to require an advisory group to begin working on that, and we want to work with them on that to try to get the answers as to what standard needs to be in place, and it may, in the end, it may not be a sulfur standard, or it may be standards that are particular to specific watersheds. So this leads me back to my main point, is that we can't, because there are so many unanswered questions, the bottom line is that we cannot require a permittees, whether they be municipalities or industries, to expend millions of dollars to comply with a standard that could be a different standard within a few years.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Mr. Chair, I'd ask, I don't know, there's certainly a lot of people with environment-type related interests in the room. Is there anybody in the room that knows if we've had wild rice that has been damaged by these facilities for reasons of sulfate or other reasons?
Representative Drazkowski, I believe we're going to hear from a number of folks, and they're aware of your question now. So
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen, and then we're going to hear from Senator Hottinger. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robertson, I listened closely to your testimony, and you talked about trying to find a science-based answer to this, and I think most everybody would agree with that. And you talked about the bottom line being trying to make sure, not holding people to a standard. And you talked about Section 14, but I didn't hear any comment on Section 15. Where the bill establishes a standard in statute. And I have a question if that is somewhat of a rare characteristic of establishing that standard in statute, and then what is the chamber's position on Section 15?
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I hope it is a rare circumstance when the legislature will propose establishing scientific standards in statute. I did mention this issue in the questions that I listed that I think relate to how should this issue be addressed with in relationship to the EPA. You know, what is the best position that the state can be in trying to deal with EPA on the legal matters of whether we can kind of hold in place until we have a new standard? Some folks think that repealing the standard puts us in the best position. Others think that that's not the case. As I said, the issue in Section 15 establishes a different standard. I don't know the answer to the question. What we're looking for is the bottom line and whatever circumstances we need to have in order to deal effectively with the EPA, I think, is what we're looking for.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hottinger, sorry about that. We're going to try and get you there before 9 no matter what, so I apologize. And then next it'll be Representative Rukavina. Senator Hottinger, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to testify in front of you. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is John Hottinger. I'm a St. Paul resident. I'm a principal in the firm of Hottinger and Gillette, which deals with dispute mediation, citizen engagement, public policy development, and I'm not here for any of our clients. I also am a registered lobbyist, but I'm not here for any of those clients. I'm here as a volunteer and five-year member of the executive committee of the Minnesota chapter of the Sierra Club, known as the North Star chapter. I'm also the two-year previous past president. On behalf of the Sierra Club, I want to note that we have a variety of concerns, but I'm here today to talk about the wild rice standards. And being respecting the time constraints the committee has and the process that you're going through, I'll focus on two sets of arguments, one relating to process, one relating to fundamental policy concerns. This is clearly a policy, the wild rice standards. And there's certainly money attached, and I applaud the committee for having money attached to do the kind of extensive scientific research that can provide us with a realistic and, as Mr. Robertson said, a current science evaluation of what the standard should be. Traditionally, that wouldn't be in a finance bill and should stand alone, and I hope the committee has a chance in the future to explore this more extensively. In any case, this is an important committee, this is an important issue, and given the brief time as a result of unrealistic deadlines to do the thorough job that I know you would all like to do, I would express concerns about including Section 15 in the bill at this time. As I understand, there's been no extended prior testimony in this proposal before today, and certainly not in a policy setting, including no opportunity for this committee to make some decisions evaluating scientific opinion in a thoughtful, deliberative, and reflective manner, one of the key obligations of policymakers. But let me talk about the fundamental policy concerns. While the language of Section 14 and Mr. Robertson's testimony acknowledges the need for a great deal of detailed scientific research and input from a variety of sources in order to get sound standards, Section 15 ignores that important and necessary aspect and arbitrarily makes up a standard 25 times higher than the current applicable standard. Mr. Robertson pointed out that that hasn't been enforced. Well, 8 years of foot dragging in enforcement doesn't authorize the legislature or give decent incentive for the legislature to just abandon the standard and adopt something significantly different. I wish the chamber and others would have asked for that kind of enforcement and that kind of raising of the issues during those last 8 years, or 12 years, or 16 years, or 20 years, so that this issue could have been dealt with in the way it should be dealt with, allowing scientists and people who have done studies that give us information to explore and to give the legislature good advice and or the agency to bring about a decision that's based on sound science. It's a flagrant and transparent effort to do this by legislation 25 times higher than the current standard, which will dramatically reduce environmental protection, and it's being done, frankly, to allow some projects with high risks to get established under very permissive, reduced standards. As I observed the public discussion of the recently passed law to streamline environmental permitting, which this committee approved and the governor signed, I heard the continuous refrain that no one wants to lower environmental standards. 2 weeks later, or less than 2 weeks later, we have a provision in Section 15 that indicates that refrain was inaccurate. Members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I know that some other witnesses will answer some of the questions raised about damage in wild rice where the sulfate ratings are higher. But I know that you, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee want to do the best job you possibly can, and I would suggest that you not include Section 15 in your bill, allow the normal process to work its way through and find out what's best for Minnesota from an environmental perspective and from an economic perspective and weigh those risks. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the time you've granted me and members of the committee.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Hottinger? Senator, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting me down to talk on this issue. As you know, Mr. Chair, well, you're going to get a cup of coffee. I had introduced a bill that I believe you kind of used parts of, if not all of, other than the fact that I had a little different number that I plugged in. And the reason that I introduced the bill is, members and Mr. Chair, is that this whole issue of wild rice first came to me and Senator Tomasoni's attention and former Representative Sertich. I think it was late last summer when we were contacted. Senator Tomasoni and I had a phone conversation with three personnel members of the pollution control agencies. And actually after that conversation, we really didn't understand where the issue came from. I'm more confused than ever about actually how this got put into rule and why it was never really enforced, as Mr. Robertson pointed out. So as we delve into it more, to be quite frank, I believe that, you know, this was rule was found that had never really been enforced by some folks who are opposed to copper nickel mining. But members, it's jumped far beyond that, as Mr. Robertson pointed out. And I don't know which map that you received. I have two different maps that I believe Bar Engineering did. Bar Engineering was doing some studying of this issue for Mesaba Nugget. You members know that Mesaba Nugget is the new plant that produces pig iron nuggets that are can go right into a mini mill that's operating on the old LTV site. And when they went to permit a small mine that will not have a kiln, they'll take their concentrate and put it right into the rotary hearth. Everything was kind of going smoothly, according to what they told us 2 weeks ago. and they started in 08 to permit that little taconite mine on the site of the old LTV mine. In March of 09, they brought in actually the tribal communities to a meeting with the DNR and I believe the PCA. Someone at that meeting for the first time brought up this wild rice standard. They were told, don't worry about it, it's really never been enforced. And then in February of 10, this last February, they were called and told by the supervisor for this permitting process at the PCA that they had to meet the standard. So they started doing significant research, and I believe that's where you got the maps. I don't know which map was handed out by Mr. Robertson.
Representative Rukavina, I believe the map we have is probably a combination of the two maps you have. We have a map that shows where wild rice is in the state of Minnesota, the wild rice waters, and then overlaid we have a map of all the affected different wastewater treatment plants, industrial sites. Is that not the two maps that you have, Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, you have the map, I believe, that shows all of the different facilities that are discharging into wild rice waters. I have a map of, and they're color-coded by what they are. I have just a map that was initially done by VAR that just shows all of the permitted facilities, and it's all this red all the way through all of Minnesota, basically, except the metro area and what looks to be like the St. Cloud area. And those are those are wild rice waters through this whole area of Minnesota. So I have two maps, but regardless, as Mr. Robertson pointed out, this has become a much bigger issue than just copper nickel mining because, members, both of my grandfathers came from Croatia and Italy to the Iron Range in 1904. And so, you know, and my daughter just had my first grandchild, so we've been on the range for five generations, my family. And we've been mining ore since 1882, I believe, when the first actual digging started up in Representative Dill's district in the Sudan Underground, near the Sudan Underground mine, which, of course, was on fire this weekend, but I don't know what kind of sign that is. But anyway, you know, as I said, so this has jumped, and there's 3,600 taconite miners spread across the Iron Range. When Keetac went to get their permit, Keewatin Taconite, they had to all of a sudden face this issue. They were given a permit to dewater, and to meet that standard for dewatering an old natural ore mine over 8 years, I believe, 92 months, if I'm not mistaken.
96 months.
96 months, excuse me. Esther Steele, we don't know what's going to happen at Esther Steele, members, because those pits that have to be dewatered, the old natural ore pits that were mined out during World War II, contain anywhere from 65 to 80 milligrams per liter of sulfate. And we're talking billions of gallons of water. And Mesaba Nugget, where they have to dewater, three of the pits have 11.8, 10, and 8 billion gallons of water in them. And so this is a huge issue for iron ore mining, but for all the different agricultural and wastewater treatment facilities that are discharging all around the state. And you can't just pick on one a particular industry. You have to apply the research evenly. So I introduced the bill, Mr. Chair. I had, as I said, a little different number than you plugged in. I'm assuming you used 250 because that's the drinking water recommendation in the state of Minnesota for sulfates. I don't know, you know, if that was your reasoning, but it's a frightening issue for us. It is, as Mr. Robertson said, the perfect storm that's developed here. And all I was trying to do was to try to find the right science, because in talking to members at the PCA, no one really can talk about what science was done. Yes, this expert at the DNR in the 40s, 50s, and 60s did field research, but we don't know what kind of science is involved in it. So I'm glad that you know, this issue is being discussed. I believe Mr. Robertson is right. Representative Dill, Representative Purcell, and Representative Hilty were at a meeting in Duluth a few weeks ago when I asked the person from the EPA from Chicago whether or not, if we changed our number, if they would leave us alone. And three times I asked the number or asked the question, and I got three answers that I still don't know what the answer was. And I don't think Representative Hilty or Purcell or Dill know what his answer was either. Finally, I said it's an easy question, yes or no, but I never got a yes or no answer. So I think this is the beginning of a discussion. No one wants to jeopardize the wild rice beds. We understand the importance to the tribal community in Minnesota of wild rice, but I don't think there's right now any science based in this. I did have Commissioner Austin in my office about 3 weeks ago when I was going to introduce this bill. Some of the language in here I discussed with him about the 2 years. He thought that might give them enough time to see what happened over two wild rice cycles, but certainly it may take longer to solve that. And in the interim, members, you have to think about an industry that's been here for 125 years that is KeyTac still has not gotten their actual permit. I don't believe they got the permit to dewater, but I don't know if they've actually gotten the permit to start to reopen that line that ran for until a few years ago for the last 30 years. So it's a real important issue. It's not just an important issue to my area, but these mines contribute hundreds of millions of dollars to our school trust funds, our permanent university funds that fuel the university and contribute a lot of money to public education in this state. And you know, we don't want a number that isn't based in science to determine what's going to happen to that industry either. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me testify, and I'll answer any questions if there are any.
Members, questions for Representative Rukavina. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, about how many municipalities would be affected if we force them to abide by this regulation?
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, I can only go by the number that you have on your map, 285, but I was given some numbers yesterday by a constituent who does a lot of testing around the state and, you know, across northern Wisconsin and that, and the drinking water coming in to quite a few communities across the Iron Range, coming into their wastewater system is anywhere from I think about 30 to 45. I think Virginia's where I grew up, and you know, I've been drinking that water for years. Look at how normal I am. But anyway, the discharge out of there for the last half a year is in the 60s and 70s because the water coming in is in the 30s and 40s every month. And that's just one community where I live. And I'm assuming in areas of the state where I've heard that the drinking water is in the 1,000, close to 800 to 1,000 in southwestern Minnesota, that those discharges have to be similar. So the PCA should have this information. They have a rule that they're supposedly are concerned about, and they permitted all these plants, and I don't know what information they have. I don't have it. I can only go Representative Quam anecdotally in my district.
Well, thank you, Representative Rukavina. The number actually is 385 on municipal plants.
And Mr. Chair, our discharges in Virginia have been anywhere from April of 210 from 85 milligrams per liter to in lows as low in August of 65.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. I was just the number of municipal is 385. Representative Quam, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad that we're researching. You know, this because of your testimony's indication of long-term effects on the drinking water at those levels. But is there any idea how much of a fee we'd have to apply to wild rice to in order to pay for all of the facilities that we'd have to build for these municipalities, and how many years at a, you know, at a high fee rate to be able to offset, and you know, all these municipalities would spend millions of dollars possibly each, to comply?
Mr. Chair, I'm certainly not, you know, have no information on that, nor am I smart enough to even comment on it.
Thank you. Representative Quam, I don't know if we could calculate that, but maybe if some of the agency people would have an idea, they could maybe think about being able to answer that. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, what number did you plug into your bill, and what was the basis or for the number that you used?
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I plugged in the number 50, and because I thought it was, you know, a number I pulled out of the air, I guess, like maybe it was pulled out. It was one-fifth of the water that we could drink. So I thought if we can drink 250, a reasonable number to start at, but I have no science. But the point being that I don't know where the science is in the number 10 milligrams per liter either.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Anderson's point and to Representatives 50 milligrams per liter. The reason that I signed on to the bill was because when I looked at the background level of, for example, the Buell water supply. Now, Buell sells water essentially worldwide from around a 4,000-foot deep well.
600 feet.
Oh, is it 600? Oh, I'm thinking about the
600 feet, but Representative Bill, if I say water that they claim is over 40,000 years old.
That's what I'm talking
about. Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I looked at those background levels, and I thought, well, if by chance that they pumped the water out of the well and it didn't go into the bottles, and it just ran down a ditch into a receiving water of wild rice, that based on the standard that's currently in law, the wild rice could potentially be harmed. And it didn't make any sense to me that the background level for all these wells on the Iron Range are much, much higher, 2, 3, 4, 5 times higher than the standard that's in law. We're drinking it. It doesn't all go into bottles. And that number 50 seemed reasonable in terms of what we actually have for waters in the background of that area, particularly that area where there's mining, and particularly where there are these undewatered pits that have, you know, even substantially higher. So that's the reason that I signed on to the bill. And another reason I signed on to the bill, frankly, was to try and help accelerate this discussion. I mean, you know, sometimes when my son, who is almost always happy to do whatever I ask, like all sons do, they need to be prodded along a little bit. And so, I mean, the way we accelerate things around here and get discussions flowing is to introduce bills that are intriguing and difficult to deal with. And this is one of them. And so I'm happy to support that bill. I don't know that I believe that 50 is the right number either. But some number is, and we need to know it as soon as possible. And so that's the reason I went and I'm not as obliged to go along with the 250, because that seems maybe a little bit farther than we should, or maybe a fair amount farther than we should go in one leap. And also, I was at that meeting, and I'll concur that we got nothing from the EPA. I mean, Representative Rukavina, in his very, in a way that only he can ask questions, tried.
I take that as a compliment, but I don't know if it was meant as one.
And we didn't get an answer from them. So that's the reason that I was supporting the 50 number.
Mr. Chair.
Comment, Representative Rukavina.
One quick response that I should mention, because Representative Dill brought it up. And, you know, in those old natural ore mines, where in the 4 years of World War II, we mined one-third of all the ore that's been mined since 1882. And all those natural ore pits are filling up with water. Some of the communities like Virginia use that water supply as their drinking water. Others don't. Representative Wagenius, you know the issue of the Canisteo pit, and because we've been trying to dewater it. Representative Anzeltz told me yesterday the number in that pit, and it's in the hundreds. And that pit is going to overflow very soon. The only thing holding it back, because the DNR has not moved forward on dewatering that pit, and I said these pits have billions of gallons of water. The only thing holding that water back right now is the ballast from the Canadian National Railroad. And once that water reaches that ballast on the railroad, it's going to flow out. And it's going to flow into Trout Lake and into, I believe, that would be the Mississippi River. I'm not sure. But, you know, that's a lot of pits. The old ore pits on the range are in that. That's what's happening to them. They're filling up with water. And those numbers are significantly higher than, you know, some of them in the thousands. And it has to be addressed, and so we have to get the science to address this.
Well, I think, Representative Rukavina, you've alluded to how important the study is and to move it as fast as we can forward, but realizing Mother Nature, one season a year is all we have, and granted, some we may be able to do in the laboratory, but we got to make sure that we have buy-in from all the folks affected by this so that the study is something that folks will accept as a new level, whatever it may be. We don't know, as I think we all agree, we don't know. So, Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's why I tried to include in my legislation all the different parties that are.
Well, Representative Rukavina, you've never been afraid of getting into a tough subject, and we appreciate your work on this one of many tough projects that you've jumped on. Representative Anderson.
Just a follow-up statement, Mr. Chair. Is it a statement, a true statement, that even though we've had this 38-year-old standard on the books, up until at least a couple months ago, we have really not had any number enforced? Would that be a correct statement?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Anderson, I would say it would be. As I said, the first time Mesaba Nugget heard, the first time we heard about it was last summer. Mesaba Nugget did hear about it in February of 2010. For the first time.
And Representative Rukavina and to Representative Anderson, U.S. Steel has signed a permit that applies the level of 10 to the 96 months out you've talked about, with the understanding they begin immediately to do design engineering work to reach that level of 10 8 years out. There's significant equipment that needs to be designed. Some of it we don't even know if the engineering there is yet to do that. So that's the path they're on based on the application of this level of 10 for maybe only the second time. There was one, as Representative Rukavina mentioned, there was a time in the 70s when it was mentioned, but it wasn't applied. So actually it would be the first time that it's been applied. For whatever reason, unfortunately, it's been sitting there, you know, and it got dusted off at this time, but it's dusted off now. We need to move forward, and Representative Rukavina, Representative Dill, and
yes, Mr.
and
Chair.
Us have been thrown in the middle of this. Representative Rukavina.
And I'm not, Keetac is in Representative Anzelt's district. My understanding, and the DNR can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the permit they received over the next 8 years, it was for dewatering an old natural ore pit where they're going to get at the taconite underneath it. I still think, and if the DNR is in the room, I'm sure they are, that they need to get another permit. And what that permit is, what standard will be applied there, I have no idea.
Thank you, Representative Rubino. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You brought up this testimony, and your comments brought up the thought and remembrance. I worked at a semiconductor facility near the Mall of America in Bloomington. Our discharge was too clean. And we had to add contaminants in it in order to be able to reach a level that wasn't disruptive to the river and the watershed. If we start enforcing this level of 10 and the ambient and existing levels are 1 to 2 orders of magnitude greater, are there any elements of the ecosystem that would be adversely affected by switching all of our municipalities and industries to their effluents being too pure? And I'm not sure who would answer that question, but I do know that it's come up before that you cannot discharge too pure of water or you will drastically affect the ecosystem.
Do you want, Representative Quam, do you want to see if somebody from MPCA is here and wants to address your concern? MPCA, do you, why don't we, Representative Quam, I guess, thank you. Ms. Slothammer, she's going to come down. Ms. Slothammer, did you hear the question?
Yes, Commissioner.
I'm glad you didn't have to repeat it. Good. Ms. Slothammer, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the manager of the Water Assessment and Environmental Information section at the PCA, which includes our Standards Development Group. And Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, we do have ways in our permitting process where if the background or the natural concentrations are higher than a particular standard, we can account for that in the permitting process in setting the effluent limits or the discharge requirements. And that is a pathway that we look at when we're doing permitting.
Follow up, Representative Quam.
So then, you know, from the testimony, I've been led to believe that the neighboring or affluent is higher than this level of 10. Is that being taken into account on this very first instance where we're enforcing that level of 10? You know, can you expound upon that?
Ms. Lockhammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I am actually not familiar with all of the details of the permitting review for the particular permit discussion that we're talking about. I can speak generally to kind of how the process works. And we do look at what information is available to establish what the background levels are. That can be really challenging, in particular in the situation with wild rice and the sulfate standard. You know, we need more information to really be able to evaluate and quantify what a healthy stand of wild rice is. That's something that we're really hoping to, and we intend to work towards getting out of the sulfate study that has been discussed, because that's an important element of determining, you know, is the background concentration truly background, or is it historical releases that have occurred that have elevated that from maybe what was natural, if you will? And then also, is that still resulting in healthy stands of wild rice? And those are variables that right now we use site-specific information that are specific to each situation to do our best to evaluate, and we're really looking to the study to get us some better tools for doing that going forward.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My last follow-up is, can we find out what the background measurements that were taken in this permitting process, because I know they did very thorough work to better understand those levels in our discussion. So I'd just like to be able to have the committee know all these background levels that were taken before the permit to force them to 10 was enforced.
But Representative Quam, if I could qualify, and Ms. Lockhammer, you could correct me if I'm wrong. The permittee agreed to a sulfate standard that's yet to be determined, but if a sulfate standard is not changed for whatever reason, it would become a level of 10 for them 8 years out, and they would need to be meeting that number at that time. I think that's basically where we're at, understanding the need for new scientific data if we're going to enforce this standard. That's where we're at. So they're not automatically agreed to a lock on 10, but it will be 10 if there's not action. Is that basically where we're at?
Mr. Chair, yes, basically that description.
Thank you, Ms. Lockhammer. Was it to this point, Representative Purcell? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just having reviewed some of the specific information, Representative Quam, I would just offer to you that the receiving waters are both above and below. And it's unfortunately not as clear-cut as you and I as science guys would like it to be.
Representative Dill.
Oh, thank you very much, Chair McNamara and Lockhammer. A few days ago, I asked about the use of fertilizers on wild rice crops. And I'm thinking about, frankly, up in the Gonvick and Clearbrook and up in that area where there are substantial rice paddies close to Red Lake and the I believe it's the Clearbrook River. And I've been told that they put on onto the fields of wild rice potash. Representative Purcell and others have told me that has sulfates in it. And that's going to be an interesting part of this, in that not only are we talking about the mining industry and wastewater treatment plants and things of that nature, but now we're talking about a whole other industry that kind of nobody's paying much attention to in this whole discussion. And I'm wondering if you had looked into that, or if anyone could comment on that from the agency, if in fact sulfates are a part of the fertilizer that's used, and how that might affect. And does anyone know what the discharge from those rice paddies are that's going into the Clearbrook River? And obviously the Clearbrook River is a receiving water for wild rice.
Ms. Lockhammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, unfortunately I haven't had a chance to look to see what information we might have about that. I do know that, you know, paddy-grown rice and the conditions under which paddy rice is grown and natural stands of wild rice are both questions that have come up as, we've started to talk to people about developing the study protocol. And certainly that's something that, we're taking a look at as we put that protocol together, is, you know, how much to look at both paddy-grown rice and natural stands of wild rice, or where to focus attention so that we can move forward to address the sulfate standard in particular. But I just haven't had a chance to look in particular into that question.
Representative Dill, follow-up?
No.
Representative Purcell, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just need to make sure that clarify what I did say and to Representative Dill, and I appreciate that. What I said was that there is, I'm confident there is sulfur in potash, and I want to make, because there are undoubtedly various species associated with sulfur, but I have no assay of potash to say that there's sulfate, Representative Dill. That's the word you used. I just need to be clear about that, because as a chemist there can be quite a difference there, but I'm confident there's sulfur.
Thank you. Representative Dill.
Okay, well, I don't want to pick on potash, because that's a real fine fertilizer, but any fertilizers that they use that might have sulfates in it, I hope that will be a part of the scope of your work.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just comment to the discussion that Representative Dylan Purcell had. If indeed they are fertilizing these crops, I don't know a lot about wild rice, but it's a grass, and grasses are consumers of nitrogen. It could be that they're using ammonium sulfate as a nitrogen source, one of the common nitrogen fertilizers. But I would ask Ms. Lockhammer, I asked Mr. Robertson earlier if the business community was aware of any wild rice kills or damages that have been done by the current rates of discharge of whatever is coming out of these ostensibly hundreds of industrial and municipal plants in these waters. Are you familiar from the environmental regulation community, if you will, of any particular waters that have been documented or reported to have wild rice kills because of these discharges that have been going on?
Ms. Lockhammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I know that there have been a number of studies that have shown that wild rice is declining across Minnesota. I don't know that specific factors have been isolated. You know, the work that the original work that was done to establish the sulfate standard looked at the distribution of wild rice and sulfate concentrations and found that above about 10 milligrams per liter, the wild rice stands tended to be less productive and tended to be less robust. But as far as kind of specific cause and effects, that's one of the questions that is potentially a subject for the study, is to look more at that particular mechanism for how sulfate specifically might be affecting wild rice, and also for helping to better kind of understand what constitutes a healthy stand of wild rice and how we can quantify that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Ms. Lockhammer, has anyone called your agency and suggested that the wild rice is not growing well because of the discharge coming out of XYZ plant?
Ms. Lockhammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, there have certainly been calls and comments that have raised concern about sulfate concentrations and effects on wild rice. I'm not sure if there's been a specific call about a specific situation or a specific stand, but we've definitely heard comments about concerns about sulfate and wild rice impacts.
Representative Drazkowski, follow-up.
Chair, thank you. So, Ms. Lockhammer, as I understand your agency, normally if you have a standard and someone is calling and reporting that there is a problem with a particular discharge of something that may be conflicting with a standard, I understand you people back in each other getting out of the parking lot to get there. I'm curious if that is happening here. It sounds like has not been reported. I'd be interested in you expounding more precisely. Have you heard from people and then went out and observed situations in which there has been wild rice that has either declined directly or been killed by discharges, ongoing discharges by these hundreds of plants in Minnesota?
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, you know, the sulfate and wild rice question is a little different than like a spill situations where we get a report of a spill and we do go out immediately to take samples and figure out what's going on. You know, there we're more worried about acute toxicity where something immediately gets impacted. With sulfate and wild rice and impacts on wild rice, the concern is more about declines over time. So as we've been getting comments about concerns about sulfate, we've been ramping up our monitoring efforts to incorporate sulfate monitoring into our more routine monitoring. And we've also, as I think others have noted, we've been incorporating sulfate monitoring requirements into permits as they come up for reissuance so we can get that information that we need in order to evaluate whether or not a particular discharge has the potential to cause problems with our wild rice waters.
Well, that's follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Lockhammer, there has not been any acute damages that you're aware of from these plants. So, as I hear your testimony, you're suggesting or characterizing that if there are problems, it would be other than these acute type of situations. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I'm not aware of any acute, like, immediate kills. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. I just don't have that information in front of me. But I do know that typically the concern is more of a chronic overtime concern with a pollutant like sulfate and impacts on wild rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Lockhammer.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're sitting here debating this science, I was trying to think back to my high school chemistry and what happens with these various reactions. So, and I know we've got a lot of teachers in the body, but it might be good to get a sheet that shows the chemistry, the basic chemical reactions, because if I remember, sulfuric acid, it breaks down to sulfate, and then there's a sulfite. There's different reactions that happen at different times with different catalysts and different temperatures and different metals as water moves through different ores or different products. And it's been a while, and the coffee's just kicking, and I'm trying to remember those things. We can't go to the books there for a basic organic chemistry. But when we're being asked to debate these things, I think it'd be helpful just to have a very simple sheet, and maybe that research can provide it. Just take us back to our high school chemistry. And so we understand the terms that we're talking about, not their effects, but just what we're talking about in terms of the chemical reactions that occur in nature and how those are affected with different reagents or agents or temperature or catalysts or conditions. That would help us, I think, overall. And maybe the agency could get us a little sheet on that, because it would be helpful for me to remember that, because you've got the iron ore, if we're talking fertilizer, you may have P2SO4, you may have phosphorus, or you may have different things are going to react different ways and have different end products. And the cycle that occurs is affected by different things. So if somebody could get us that information, I think it might help out in this whole debate.
Ms. Lothammer, could you see what you could do before we come back at 4:30, if you could have some kind of a basic sheet? Thank you. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, again, to have facts on the table. We've been talking about decline over time of wild rice, and we have a snapshot of today, and I know that there are maps available about where wild rice was pre-settlement. And if you could bring those maps for us this afternoon so we could see what the decline over time has looked like, that would be helpful.
another one, if possible, if we could have that by 4:30, we'll that'd be great. To members of the audience, we have about 10 people on the list. Is there anyone of those 10 that has a problem coming back this afternoon at 4:30 or traveled from a long ways? We're going to, okay, there's about four of you, so we're going to give each of you about 2 minutes to testify. Melinda Suflo, if you're in the audience, do you want to come forward and give us a couple minutes? And I'm going to have to be honest. You're going to have to limit your testimony to 2 minutes as we do this. So if you could make your key points right away, so when you get cut off after 2 minutes, we'll get the points you want to make. Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my name is Melinda Suflo, and I've got some things written down, so I think I can be brief. This is actually my racing partner, Matt Tyler, who's up here with me. We live in Findlay, Minnesota. I harvest wild rice, and I manage a small organic vegetable farm in CSA. And the wild rice that I harvest is a major staple of my diet. And it's very important to me to be able to grow and harvest as much local food as possible, because I believe in local food systems and that they provide the healthiest foods for myself and for all communities across Minnesota. And I joined a group, Water Legacy, to make sure that my voice gets heard in protecting our wild rice resource. We drove 5 hours to get down here today just to speak on behalf of ourselves as ricers and a number of friends in the Finland area who couldn't come down here today. And I believe that wild rice is a unique and important resource in Minnesota. Hundreds of people are involved in the harvest and processing and selling of rice in our area each year, and thousands more benefit when they're able to buy these natural Minnesota wild rice products as a healthy food for their families. So for these reasons, I'm here just to let you know I oppose any change in the sulfate standard of 10 milligrams per liter for natural stands of wild rice in Minnesota. Experience and research has shown that this is the correct water quality sulfate standard for Minnesota, and that wild rice doesn't thrive in higher sulfate levels. I believe that arbitrarily raising the standard to 25 times the current level just doesn't make any sense. The DNR has in the past tried to establish natural stands of rice at higher sulfate levels, and their efforts have failed. So it's my opinion that sections 14 and 15 of this bill should be removed before the financing bill goes forward. I don't object to any further study of wild rice and sulfates and how other substances affect the growth of the rice. But I'm a little concerned. I'm not sure it's the job of the legislature to micromanage this study. I'm aware that the MPCA is engaged in their own review process, and any study should be done independently by scientific experts through that process.
Thank you.
I need to say one more thing.
You know, we drove 4 hours and other guys got...
Excuse me, sir, could you introduce yourself for the record? You spoke on the record. If you could tell me your name and who you represent. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Matt Tyler, and I represent myself. I'm a wild ricer as well. She's my rice partner.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Continue, ma'am.
Well...
Sir, continue.
Yeah, I just wanted to say also, our friend Warner Huerta, who's a elder of the Neck Lake tribe, couldn't make it here today, but he's been very, very concerned about these issues. And, you know, Net Lake Tribe, as you know, or maybe don't know, has had a major decline in their rice, and they're right up there along the Iron Range. And it's hard to say what the cause is. No one's studied it yet, so we don't know. But he wanted me to pass along that wild rice is a extremely important thing to his people, and that not only as a food source, but as a spiritual gift from the Creator. Now, you know, most people would be pretty upset if someone went into their church and wrecked their church. I think he feels justifiably upset if other people are messing around with his spirituality and his culture. So the other thing is someone did say that no other state has a standard for this. And one of the reasons for that is that we have, it's a unique plant that's only found in the Great Lakes region. And we have some of the largest and most diverse and most productive stands of it that are natural in the entire country and in North America. So, as you heard today, the majority of Minnesotans support our water quality standards, and they did not elect their public officials on a campaign to undermine these standards. It's your job to protect our wild rice and our waters, and frankly, my livelihood as well. So, one other thing I'd like to address is someone asked, is there wild rice kills that have been documented? There's a professor,
Mr. Tyler, you're going to have to wrap it up. You're testing my patience. She has to come down. You're not on the list. She asked to hold her testimony to 2 minutes.
All right.
You've been going on for 5 minutes. Representative Wiginia.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I think given the importance of this, that we need to respect the citizen input here. This is extraordinarily important. And what we do as a legislature is listen to our communities. And this is one of the communities that has driven 5 hours. I want to hear what they have to say.
Representative Wiginius, Ms. Soufflou asked to come down and testify. Three other people raised their hand and said they can't come back after 10 o'clock. Mr. Tyler was not one of them. He came and sat at the testifying table and interrupted. I asked him to speak his name so his interruption could be noted on the record. He then testified for 2 minutes, and the three people in the audience that raised their hand and signed up to testify are not going to get to testify now.
Yeah, I
yield. Further comment, sir, you will not interrupt. You are out of order, and you will pay attention. The sergeant at arms will escort you out of the room if you don't. Ms. Soufflou, do you have anything more to add?
I finished the comments.
Thank you. The next testifier that raised their hand could come forward. Christine Dawson.
Right. My name is Christy White Dawson.
Ms. Dawson, you need to sit at the testifying table to speak. We're not allowed to stand in the room. You are not. Thank you. You could identify yourself for the record if you could sit by the microphone.
That was my first time. Okay. I'll start again. Okay. I gave myself 3 minutes. You'll have to cut me off. Okay. My name is Christy Dawson. I was born in 1940. 1954, I lived in Cleveland, Ohio. I saw the Cuyahoga River burn. I read Rachel Carson. I was 14 years old. I heard the voice of common sense. I heard the voice of truth. My parents were intellectuals. They talked about how human beings could control everything, how we could figure it all out, how we were becoming gods. I don't think so. In 1956, at 16, I went to the University of Chicago. I studied American history. We were taught to work on the basis of organizations, methods, and principles of the sciences. The science changes from year to year. It changes from decade to decade. I go by the principles, and I'm asking you to think about the principles. I'm asking you to look into your human hearts and say to yourselves, do I really want to put whatever kind of sulfuric acid do I want to put that in the groundwater of my state, in the land of my children? Do I want to raise this content? In 1998, I bought my first land. I bought land that I loved, a cabin in northern Minnesota. It's a mile from a wild rice lake. 94 acres. I bought it because I loved it. What I am looking at is the sulfite mines, voracious, irresponsible, and property-driven sulfite mines. Rio Tinto want to come in the area. I have watched. I lived 12 years in Two Harbors from 1970 to 1982. I watched businesses come in. I watched people turn around and say, oh, jobs. We'll give you anything if you'll give us a few jobs. I saw people working. I saw them losing their jobs. I saw them still getting by. I saw it over and over again. All I can say is this. The greatest global resource in Minnesota is the passionate need, the longing of the next generation for healthy nature and for clean water. You can't have it both ways. Either you nurture this garden that we already have, or you turn it into an industrial wasteland. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Dawson? I don't see any. Is there one other testifier that won't be able to come back? We're only going to have time for one more. Go ahead. Come ahead. If you're together, come ahead. Thank you. You're all right. Go ahead. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
My name is Bess Bover. I'm a college student.
Can you spell your last name, please? Thank you.
Bover, that's B-O-E-V-E-R. I was on there as Bev, but
thank
it's
you.
Bess with two S's. Wild rice is our state grain, and it has been for over 30 years. It is a symbol of our state, which represents us internationally. Most of the wild rice in the world is produced in Minnesota and exported from Minnesota. That is how we are recognized internationally. Visitors buy it on the North Shore to remember their trip. It is on the cover of our cookbooks. We teach our kids about it. Why would we legislate its demise? The MPCA has repeatedly affirmed that 10 milligrams per liter is the standard needed to protect our wild rice, and it has been observed that wild rice generally doesn't even grow in waters where 50 milligrams per liter are present. Not only is this grain an ecological treasure, a food staple sacred to many, and the livelihood of many, but it is also an emblem of Minnesota culture. Now, the mining industry and others want to roll back our standards because our current clean water standards are hard for them to meet. Well, things will be worse if it is caused that naturally growing wild rice, a Minnesota legacy, will all but disappear from its native waters. For this reason, as a Minnesota native, I must strongly encourage you to reconsider sections 14 and 15 in this bill and protect our clean water for the sake of our state symbol's survival. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Ajuat Kapishisit, Indigenous Cause, Atik Do Dam. My name is Ajuat Kapishisit. I am of the White Earth Ojibwe and Moose Cree First Nation of Canada. I also go to school with Bess, and I am here representing the White Earth Land Recovery Project on behalf of Bob Shimmick, who could not make it here today. I have just one quick statement, and I'll just leave it at that. Wild rice, or manomen, is a sacred food of great cultural, nutritional, and economic significance to the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe people of Minnesota and throughout the Great Lakes region. Manomen is central to our spiritual teachings and as well has provided for our people for millennia. Wild rice is the only treaty-protected grain in North America and is explicitly mentioned in treaties with the U.S. government, including the 1837 and 1854 treaties, and is essential in subsequent treaty determinations. Wild rice only grows in this region, and in all studies over the past 50 years, requires a pristine lake and water quality standards to be maintained. In a long set of studies, it was determined that sulfate concentrations above this level, 10 milligrams per liter, are detrimental to the growth of wild rice. Some 90% of the areas in Minnesota in which wild rice was found had waters with less than 10 parts per million, and that there were no large and important natural or self-perpetrating wild rice stands in Minnesota where the sulfate ion content exceeded 10 parts per million. From what we understand, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency will establish new rules governing maximum sulfate levels in wild rice waters, but until the new rules are adopted, this bill would change the current 10 milligrams per liter maximum to roughly 250 milligrams per milligram per liter. This will not allow for the continuation of our wild rice. The only reason this 40-year standard is being challenged at this point is to allow for the expansion of mining operations in an area where there are wild rice lakes and beds. This is in particular true with the proposals of the proposed Polymet mine near Ely, Minnesota, an area well within the 1854 Treaty of the Anishinaabe, and thus protected as a treaty right for the Ojibwe people. In numerous occasions over the past several years, the Ojibwe have voiced opposition to these regulatory changes. Although mining interests in the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit in December of 2010 to block enforcement of the Minnesota Water Quality Standard that prevents high levels of sulfate pollution in waters with wild rice, we support the intervention by Water Legacy and other advocates and wish to ensure that our wild rice is protected. There is no place where wild rice and mining tailings or mining discharges exist in the state of Minnesota. And there has been a significant loss already of valuable wild rice beds and lakes in our region. The change in the standard would be to the detriment of wild rice, the Anishinaabe, and all Minnesotans. The change in the standard would be a violation of the treaty guaranteed protection of the wild rice of this region, Anishinaabe, Agakin. Miigwech, thank you very much.
Thank you. Question? We're in recess till 4:30. We'll bring the meeting back to order. Members, we've got, is Mr. Peterson, he was not there this morning. Yeah, why don't you come forward, Mr. Peterson, from Farmers Union. He wanted to speak to the bill in general, and you weren't there this morning. Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I apologize for not being here this morning. Had many good excuses, but we did just want to mention that some of our concerns with the bill, and understand the position you're in, that and I think it was stated last night that a lot of our farmers use the local delivery systems for implementing the different farm programs, and specifically one of the concerns is the size of the cut to the soil SWC conservation delivery program grant. As you know, Mr. Chairman, the farm bill, the U.S. farm bill, has got considerably greener since 1985. We had CSP or CRP in 1985, but as we've added programs, we now have CRP, WRP, CREP, EQIP, CSP, all these things come into things that farmers are doing, and we're using the local delivery system a lot of times and working with the local SWCD offices to get farmers enrolled in that program and help them. Also, concerns about the general cut to Bowser. I mentioned that the importance of items such as the drainage work group that Representative Hansen has helped us get started and worked on, but that's been a really good collaboration. I think a lot of members have had issues and concerns about drainage, and it's been a good group to bring together farm groups, state agencies, environmental groups to work on drainage issues. And finally, I just mentioned a concern that we have and trying to figure out the impact on the County Feedlot Officer Grant Program and what that's going to mean of the impact of a 15% cut. Does that mean FTEs, or does that mean time in the field for going out for doing inspections, or does it mean assistance to farmers who are trying to permit or move their permitting along? Are there going to be problems in some areas with that? And I hope that the County Feedlot Officers Association has somebody testify at some point or is able to relay that, because that is a concern too. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Appreciate it. Questions? Thank you. Thanks for coming in. Next, we'll get back to wild rice. Bruce Anderson? It was a Bruce Anderson, and then there was also Courtney Butcher. Kevin Prosholt. Sorry if I butchered it. If you could,
you're pretty close, Mr. Chairman.
Well, if you could identify yourself for the record and then let us hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Prosholt, and I work for the Isaac Walton League of America. The Isaac Walton League is a longtime mainline conservation organization that's been around since 1922. Working on a whole variety of natural resource issues. We have 38,000 members nationally, about 1,500 members here in the state of Minnesota, and 18 chapters spread out throughout the state. Our members are primarily hunters, anglers, and others who actively use and visit the outdoors. As fishermen and hunters, we recognize the value and the importance of wild rice in the aquatic ecosystem, not only for people and Native Americans, but particularly for wildlife, waterfowl, ducks, as well as the importance of fine water quality for fishing purposes as well as for other aquatic life. Our organization strongly supports retention of the 10 milligrams per liter standard of sulfate for wild rice. We believe that the research that was conducted by Dr. John Moyle still holds up, that we've seen no evidence or other studies that would indicate that his research is not still applicable today. So we would urge the committee to retain the 10 milligrams per liter standard and not to weaken it as the legislation would propose. So that's short and sweet, Mr. Chairman. That's my statement.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier? We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Tammen, I see you're here. Welcome, Mr. Tammen. You're a familiar face to the committee members. If you could identify yourself for the record, you want to tell us where you live or who you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Tammen from Sudan, Minnesota. My wife, Pat, and I are retirees. We live in Sudan because we enjoy the quality of life. We could be snowbirds, but we've never given it a thought. We stay in Minnesota when we're not down here. And I'd like to address some of the issues that were brought up, and I've heard so much good testimony over the last few days, but there were a couple things mentioned that perhaps haven't been fully addressed. There was a question, I believe, about how much damage to wild rice has actually been suffered in northern Minnesota. And I think Representative Druskowski asked for examples. And so to that, I would mention the St. Louis River. We have approximately 100-mile dead zone of the St. Louis River. It's at least 100 miles. My wife and I do quite a bit of canoeing. We've been out in the St. Louis River with canoes. You go on the upper St. Louis River above mining activity, and there's some fairly nice beds of wild rice. You drop downstream to where it first starts picking up sulfates from mining operations. Like on the Partridge River, there's some thin, straggly beds of rice. As a matter of fact, when we saw it last fall, it wasn't high enough that you could bend over the gunwales to knock rice off of it. It wasn't even worth harvesting. You get farther down, it's a dead zone almost all the way to the estuary of the St. Louis River on Lake Superior. That rice is gone, and I think we can be pretty sure that it's a human-caused problem. And I mention this because we've heard a lot of numbers in the last few days about what levels of sulfates we have in northern Minnesota. We hear about drinking water 30, 40, 50. We hear about wastewater treatment plants that are 60, 80, that we have fairly elevated levels of sulfates. But I think if you go back over all the testimony you've heard, one place that you have not heard about elevated levels of sulfates is in our natural surface water. If it's surface water that has not been affected by human activities, mining, wastewater, farming, that surface water is less than 10 parts per million. We're in the single digits with our surface water, and I can point to perhaps an exception might help prove my point a little bit. Lake Vermilion is a huge body of water. Just a couple of years ago, Lake Vermilion averaged over the whole lake, popped up over 10 milligrams per liter. And I think as we consider this legislation, we ought to consider where those sulfates came from. They came from Mintak's tailings pond, leaking approximately 4 million gallons a day into our public waters. And close to the tailings pond, highly elevated levels of sulfates. Farther down, it's diluted, but still, it's enough to raise sulfate levels in Lake Vermilion. And as we consider this legislation, we should be very cautious about doing anything that's going to raise existing levels. We're living with a situation now we've muddled through to this place, and now we're charting a path forward. You've all seen it's going to be a difficult path because we've got every tailings pond on the Iron Range is leaking. Every active tailings pond is leaking. We're going to have to cope with that somehow or other. And I think part of coping with that should be to refuse to allow any other elevated discharges of sulfates. Let's stop the damage we're doing until we get the science done. And I know many members don't want to hear that in a time of pretty serious economic problems. And as I look in the problems of the communities where I've lived on the range. I see they all suffer pretty much the same problems. There's two dozen communities on the length of the Mesabi Range from Grand Rapids at the southwest end up to just south of Ely and northeast end. Two dozen communities. There's not a healthy Main Street in the bunch. And we've got six operating taconite plants. So as you debate this, which often sounds like a debate of balancing jobs and the environment, we should have to consider something that many of us perhaps aren't comfortable with. Mining is not one of the best economic development models we can choose. And I would ask you sometime when the rush is over, Google the resource curse. That's a theory that if you try to base your economy on selling off non-renewable resources, you usually end up with a lousy economy. And it certainly is counterintuitive, but if you look internationally, nationally, and they've done studies right down to the county level, you'll find that if they built their economy on selling off natural resources, they usually have a lousy economy. And I would point probably to Virginia, Minnesota as a perfect example. Virginia, Minnesota is surrounded by operating taconite plants, including the largest taconite plant in North America. Virginia, Minnesota is just a few miles away from the IRRRB, which is dedicated to diversifying our economy and bringing prosperity to the range. And as we listen to the redistricting testimony, Virginia, Minnesota is losing population. What should be the poster child for mining prosperity is struggling. And so I would ask that as you look through the technical problems you have to deal with, and they sell it as a jobs and clean water balance, there truly aren't that many jobs. We need to diversify in northern Minnesota. We need to quit rebating tax dollars to the mining industry. We need to get those tax dollars to Main Street. Now, I hope I'm not getting too far off of the subject of sulfates, but there's not much doubt the mining industry is driving this. We know about the wastewater treatment plants are going to have difficulty. I would remind the committee that we have a provision that if our regulations are a hardship, the commissioner of the PCA may grant a variance. And so when you hear people talking this doom and gloom that our wastewater treatment plants are going to have to spend millions and be in a crisis situation, really that's not the way we do business in Minnesota. I think I use the term muddled through. Perhaps that isn't the best term to use, but actually that's what we do in a way. We have these problems pop up, and we try to find solutions that doesn't destroy our economy and the employment. And so I would hope that as you address our problems with wild rice, that you would take that in consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tamman. Questions for Mr. Tamman? We appreciate you coming down. Appreciate you being in the audience. Mr. Bruce Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Bruce Johnson. I'm from Stacy, Minnesota.
Welcome.
I'm a retired environmental scientist. In my 34-year career, I've worked for the US EPA, Minnesota DNR, MPCA, and MnDOT. This time I've spent years in environmental research, including copper nickel mining, regulatory enforcement, and in the regulated community. The rulemaking process in the state is one of the most public and reviewed processes in the nation. The science involved is well documented. It'd be a travesty for the legislative to truncate this process. Additionally, legislative action opens the door to having all environmental regulations based on political pressure rather than good peer-reviewed science. This will serve the interests of the industry, but not the interests of the citizens of the state. I urge you to allow the existing time-tested rules processes to to work without political mandates. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions? Questions, Mr. Johnson. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, do you have any direct experience with the sulfate standards?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Torkelson.
Representative Torkelson.
Representative Torkelson. I'm sorry. I'm aware of what exists in from the copper-nickel project as sulfate in the natural environment, and I'm aware of what is existing in sulfate coming out of the Duncan mine, which is a mine that removes sulfate-bearing rock in order to get at taconite. The numbers that I'm seeing off of the Duncan mine studies for years is averaging in the neighborhood of 1,700 milligrams per liter. The copper-nickel study water quality report, which is up on the sixth floor, would indicate that most of the lakes and rivers around there, around the Ely area and around that area, are in the vicinity of 3 to 6. Now, if you come down lower on the range, more toward the mining areas down in Virginia, those numbers go up. They can go up to 30. I've seen some a little bit higher than that. Does that answer your question, sir?
I'm just thank you for that information.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next, we have Don Ernesti. Don, are you wanting to talk again? Don. Oh, did I miss him? I think I asked, didn't I?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify on this issue. My name is Don Ernesti, the policy director for the Audubon Society here in Minnesota. I'm not going to cover areas that you've already heard, but I'd like to put forward some information that has not yet been presented. The Audubon Society, as many of you know, of course, is concerned about birds, wildlife, and their habitat, and I feel that the language in Section 14 does not adequately reflect the interest of the citizens of the state in birds and wildlife and their dependency on wild rice. Specifically, I'd like to mention the language on lines 36, 24, and on down for the next couple of lines. Talk about, in my view, prohibiting the application of a future standard for wild rice protection from areas that are already degraded. So to read the last sentence in that paragraph, Section 14, paragraph A, says, waters where individual wild rice plants are isolated, the sparse stands of wild rice exist, shall not be designated as subject to the standard. I would translate that as already polluted or damaged or degraded wild rice stands will not be protected. I'd like to just briefly mention to you some Minnesota-based research about the importance of wild rice to migratory birds. Mallards, for example, Minnesota-based studies show that wild rice was 35% of their diet post-breeding. Ringneck ducks, which Minnesota is a very important state for ringneck ducks. Minnesota studies show that adults and ducklings use wild rice for 10 to 15% of their diet. Also, important habitat during molting and fall and spring migrations. 500,000 migrant ringneck ducks have been counted at Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge in wild rice habitat. I could go on and give you information about black ducks, about the American widgeon, about trumpeter swans, sora rails, American coots, yellow-headed blackbirds, and on. I feel it's very important that, I'd like to mention, let me back up a second and say the Audubon Society is very supportive of the study that's being proposed by the PCA to take a good look at the science. We feel that's an excellent way to develop protective standards. We're absolutely comfortable with a public process and a rulemaking process that would look at good science, but we feel that some of the language in Section 14 excludes consideration of some of the benefits and values of wild rice to wildlife and the people who care about wildlife. For example, the the sentence on line 36, 24, and 25 talks about documented history of wild rice, minimum acreage, and wild rice density. A question in my mind is, do we consider harvest of wild rice to be occurring by mallard ducks? Is that going to be protected, or are we talking about only human harvest? Down below, on lines 36, 32 through 36, 34, there's talk about an advisory group that has a lot of people who will be tribal governments, as long as a lot of dischargers, wild rice harvesters, and wildlife rice research experts. What about wildlife experts, people, ornithologists, and others that are expert in the use of wild rice by our wildlife? Finally, I'd like to mention some of the earlier testimony that we heard this morning by the Chamber of Commerce alluded to the fact that some of our background receiving waters have high levels of sulfate, higher than the existing standard of 10. And the implication was that dischargers would be unfairly held to a standard of 10 when perhaps the receiving water was higher than that. I'd like to point out that the Pollution Control Agency presently has flexibility within their regulations to recognize that background standards are higher than the standard, and they can already not clamp down and require people to discharge at lower levels than background. I'm not going to say a lot about Section 15, except that that's entirely unacceptable. It's pulled out of the air. It is not a protective standard designed to protect wild rice and the wildlife and people that benefit from it. It is designed to protect human health in a drinking water situation, but it's inappropriate here. I don't believe it will stand the test of the EPA review. It's probably in your best interest to strike it, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this, one of the handouts, the wild rice distribution and management wild rice lakes, I note quite a few counties, Lincoln, Lyon, Jackson, Rock, Swift, Olmsted, Dodge, that don't show any wild rice lake or river in impoundment areas. What do the ducks eat there?
Mr. Arnosti.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, I'm not saying that the wild rice is the only staple of their diet, but it is a very important component of their diet. And I specifically mentioned that, for example, mallards, 35% of their diet in the region where wild rice is available is found in wild rice. This is preferred food. In the case of ringneck ducks, it was found to be 10 to 15% of their diet. So it's not that there is no other food, but this is a very important component.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apparently, I didn't hear you. I heard the testifier earlier when they said in areas where there is wild rice. So what portions of the duck population are not in areas with wild rice, and then, you know, what do they eat?
Mr. Arnosti.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, obviously ducks eat a number of things, and of course many of them eat grain, some of the grains that we grow, as we know. They will also, depending on the species of ducks we're talking about, everything from tubers to insects to various forms of grain. Wild rice is one of the components that certain species of birds, including certain ducks, find highly attractive and a preferred part of their diet. But they obviously do eat a variety of foods, and I'm not aware of any particular bird that is solely dependent on wild rice.
Thank you. Representative Purcell, didn't you have your hand up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Quam, your second question kind of got at what I was going to say. I was going to say they fly to wild rice beds when they're in southwest Minnesota. But that's certainly ducks up in our, I mean, when they come, you know, migrating, they go to the rice beds, and some of the numbers you would see would just astound you. Not quite the blackened skies that there were 60, 80 years ago or more, but darn near. You go up and see the bluebills come into Net Lake, and anybody been up there hunting bluebills, and it's in the thousands, and it's just amazing to see that. And Net Lake is 7,000 acres of wild rice. Mr. Arnosti, I wanted to Just to add one thing, and I know I've said this before, but I think you were talking in down on 36, 32, 33 in there, and the folks that would be brought in to as an advisory group, and I just can't help but say we need to have some fisheries people in there too, because wild rice is such a fishery habitat, particularly for young of the year. I know people on the committee have heard me say that many times, but I need to say it again, so thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it. See, I just want to confirm one more time. Is Courtney Butcher in the audience? Okay. Ms. McAbee, if you want to come forward, I think you are batting cleanup here, unless there's anybody else after you. So usually a cleanup batter, Ms. McAbee, goes pretty quick. You know, they tend to swing for the fence and move on out. No, just kidding. Welcome. Good to see you again.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I appreciate the opportunity to bat cleanup. I guess the bases are pretty loaded right now. Let me go over a few things. I think we had a lot of testimony this morning about...
Ms. McAbee, could you introduce yourself for the record and who you represent?
Apologize. Paula McAbee. And I represent Water Legacy. And Water Legacy is a grassroots nonprofit organization representing a lot of people up north and some people in the Twin Cities. We've got about 1,600 members. And our mission is to protect Minnesota waters and the communities that depend on them. And we've been looking a lot at the question of wild rice. And just want to point out a couple things. First of all, similar to a lot of the testimony you've had before, we are opposed to changing the standard from 10 milligrams per liter to 250 milligrams per liter as reflected in Section 15 of the bill. From our perspective, and actually from the perspective of the Pollution Control Agency, the statements that you've heard maybe from the chamber this morning that there's a consensus that we don't have a science-based standard, we would disagree. We believe there is good science based in Minnesota, based in the field research, to support the 10 milligrams per liter standard. And that science was started by Dr. John Moyle, who went around in the 1930s and 1940s and tested wild rice and sulfates in various lakes, about 200 lakes. And what he found is that most of the lakes in Minnesota where wild rice thrived had between 2 and 10 milligrams per liter of sulfates. And that lakes with 10% or less comprised 90% of the thriving stands. And that when one got above 10 milligrams per liter, there were very few self-propagating thriving stands. And John Moyle testified in 1975 in the case having to do with applying this standard to the Clay Boswell plant. And what he said is that there was data from the fisheries department, he'd been with DNR for many years, through the 1970s testing over 2,000 bodies of water, which was consistent with his original findings that the 10 milligrams per liter is where wild rice thrives. There was some testimony this morning suggesting that that this standard has never been applied. Actually, it has been applied to the Clay Boswell plant in Cohasset. It's just as Mr. Tamman and Mr. Arnarsley both mentioned, the Pollution Control Agency currently, when they impose a permit limit, they go through a process of negotiating, and they can even be required to have a contested case hearing where there's scientific evidence and a judge and the facts are looked at closely. And a variance was granted at the Cohasset plant, primarily because the flow at that part of the Mississippi River was so high that the risk of the sulfate becoming hydrogen sulfide in the sediments was felt to be minimized. So there is a process by which flexibility is there, and the standard that's currently in law does protect the wild rice resource. Now, there's been another test of what the appropriate standard should be, because Minnesota DNR over the years tried to establish stands of wild rice in places where it wasn't occurring. And when Dr. Moyle testified once again in 1975 that in his experience, when there were elevated sulfate levels in the water, which he identified as 40 parts per million, first year the wild rice would come up decently, second year there'd be thin stands, and by year three or so there would be no more wild rice. So we've conducted experiments, DNR did, with the idea of conducting experiments, with the idea of sustaining wild rice, and came to the conclusion that higher sulfate does not permit wild rice to thrive in Minnesota. Why this is important is that according to the Clean Water Act, which is a federal statute, and the regulations promulgated under the Clean Water Act, which are federal rules, states that have water quality standards need to have standards set tight enough so that we don't degrade the uses of our waters. And that degradation time frame is counted from November of 1975. So if we had wild rice growing as one of the uses of our waters is for production of natural wild rice, our standards have to be stringent enough to protect that use. And so it's not just does the EPA in its discretion choose to approve or disapprove. There are rules, and I think I gave the committee copies of the non-degradation provision, which is 40 Code of Federal Regulations 131.12. But there are also codes of federal regulations that talk specifically about what the EPA has to look at if a state changes its rules. And the EPA has to look at, does the standard still protect the resource from degradation, and is it based on science? So a standard like the arbitrary imposition of a 250 milligram per liter limit wouldn't pass that test. So Water Legacy opposes the change to a higher limit. I think we also need to go over a little bit. I'm backpacking a little bit on what Mr. Johnson said about how our rules need to be developed. Water Legacy has reluctantly come to support the idea of the Pollution Control Agency doing additional research on wild rice and sulfates because we felt that the process that they're using is an objective process. It's not being driven by us. It's not being driven by the chamber. They're working with the tribes. They're working with the EPA. They're making sure that the experts define the protocols, and then the rest of us stakeholders get a chance to talk about it. Looking at Section 14, I know the chair said that it's important to have a credible process so that the outcome will be accepted by people. We don't believe that Section 14 is a credible process, either for studying wild rice or for developing rules. And Mr. Arnasty pointed out a couple of the areas where he felt there was a deficiency with respect to wildlife. I'm going to briefly point out some of the areas where I think there are really important deficiencies that mean if the legislature does mandate rulemaking and study according to this kind of language, what will come out will be unreliable and will be inconsistent with good science and will be subject to criticism not only by the EPA but by the scientific community. First, if you look at lines 3618 to 3620, it says the amended rule shall designate each body of water or specific portion thereof to which the wild rice water quality standards apply and the specific times of year during which the standard applies. Until the study of wild rice and sulfates is done, scientific experts couldn't even tell you whether this makes sense, whether it even makes sense to designate ahead of time every body of water. It seems also very time-consuming, very expensive, and theoretically quite unnecessary, because unless there's a sulfate discharger proposing to locate on the waters, there would have been an enormous amount of time and expense invested for no purpose. So this is inconsistent with the way the rules currently operate, which is the Pollution Control Agency looks at an industrial discharger and says, is it probable that they will have a high level of discharge? Looks at the area and says, is it probable there are wild rice in the waters? And then they ask the business to go out and take a look, do a survey. The current way of doing it is cheaper, is more reliable, and is more scientifically justified than this method. Second, I guess Mr. Arnasty said that he noticed that no wildlife experts were included in the advisory group. I think that this advisory group looks like stakeholders, not like experts. And if it's stakeholders, it's troubling that there are no members of the public and no conservation or environmental groups involved, and no groups involved and concerned about protecting clean water. And I think the most challenging part of this rule to me is Section E. And what Section E is a statement that even if someone is discharging sulfates at a level we know will degrade the resource, until some arbitrary time, the regulator, whose job it is to limit that discharge, can't do anything other than require monitoring. Not only is that bad public policy, but it's inconsistent with federal law. It's inconsistent with the Clean Water Act. And the idea that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency would basically be watching whether it's industrial dischargers, whether it's mines, destroy our resource and stand by with their hands tied is something that I think we really need to take a second look at and remove from this bill if it's going to move forward. Once again, Water Legacy supports funding for a study. We have been reluctantly brought on board with the idea that updating and making the science more sophisticated is a good idea. But we feel if that anything that comes out of that process is going to be credible, that the legislature has to let the scientists figure out the process and let the rulemaking develop according to a reasonable time that is developed by the agency. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Ms. McAbee. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McAbee, you seem to provide more detail in terms of the 1930s or 40s research than we've heard before. My question is, did the researcher or any testimony at the time say why? Why was there impairment on wild rice? Was it that it inhibited germination of the seed? Was it that that there was an acidic level that broke down the plant walls? Was it where was it? And also, it looks like we've got lakes and streams here. Were there differences in aerobic and anaerobic conditions?
Ms. McAbee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think that's why we were reluctantly persuaded that it makes sense to update the study. Because what the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources did and what Dr. Moyle did was primarily correlation. I mean, they tested the richness of the wild rice resource and the sulfates in the water and made a correlation determining what is a level in the water that was consistent with wild rice thriving. What the questions you're asking are, what are the actual aspects of water chemistry and chemistry in the sediments that are the ones that create the most risk? And the protocols that the Pollution Control Agency, and they've shared these with stakeholders, so we just got them about a week ago. The protocols that they are developing are attempting to look at, is it only the sulfates, or is it sulfates in combination with other chemicals? And is the primary impact the leafing stage in the water, or is the primary impact due to the formation of hydrogen sulfide in the sediments? The reason, the more information I have, it's all from Pollution Control Agency files. The Pollution Control Agency put a lot of their documents on a CD, and I read through a few thousand pages. So it's not that, I mean, this information is available to any member of the public who'd want to go back and spend time reading the documents.
Additional questions? Thank you, Ms. McAbee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else who wants to speak for or against the wild rice issue? Yes, ma'am. Please come forward. No, you can come to the chair and identify yourself. You'll be all right.
I wasn't on the agenda, so I didn't
know if
that was possible. My name is Margaret.
This is a free country, free state. You're free to come here and say what you have to say. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Margaret Munson. I live in St. Paul. I'm an aquatic entomologist. I'm not with any organization. I'm here to speak for all the people that care about the health of aquatic ecosystems. I can tell you that in working in wetlands, you should think of a wetland as a dynamic, living organism. It does not, nothing within the wetland exists in a vacuum. So wild rice does not exist in a vacuum. It's interacting with millions of other organisms, from those insects that I'm most experienced with, to the plants, to the soil, to the water. Microorganisms are keeping it healthy. So when you talk about wild rice, you can't think of it all by itself. As far as the sulfate levels are concerned, I don't have any experience in working with them, but Moyle's research is the basic oldest research, but nothing has disputed that yet. The research that's being done most recently, a lot of it has been done on paddy rice, that's commercially grown rice. That's not the same thing as wild natural stands of wild rice. It's also been, some of the research has been done using wild rice seeds planted in 5-gallon buckets. Some of that's been done by our University of Minnesota researchers. There's a value to that. They can look and see how sulfite affects the growing of the seeds, but they're looking at it in isolation. The sulfate issue should be looked at in combination with all the other interactions, so it's a big deal. And good research has to be done in order to figure out what is best. And right now, the research that we have that's been good shows that at 10 milligrams per liter, you have healthy stands of wild rice. And when that changes dramatically, you get decline. So all the other people that testified, I think, for the keeping the standard the way it is, are right. It isn't just human consumption, and it's of course important for the Native Americans, but wild rice also is providing habitat, food for all the ducks, and the ducks are connected to the insects, and the insects are connected to all kinds of other animals in an aquatic habitat. So I think we need to keep that standard the way it is until we have really good research, and I think PCA seems to be developing a good protocol that will support changing it. I also have not heard any mention, but maybe I missed it, that you can get methylation of mercury when sulfides are in the environment, sulfates are in the environment. Methylation of mercury is extremely toxic to all aquatic life. So there's other things to consider. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Munson. Thank you, Ms. Munson. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Munson. On that last point on methylation of mercury.
Yes.
So if we have atmospheric deposition of mercury that comes in, and we've had some testing of our lakes through the clean water funds, and if we have high sulfates, what happens there? Could you maybe tell us a little more on
Ms. Munson.
Chairman, I don't know the protocol here. I'm not real smooth with that. I'm not a chemist. All I know is that I understand in environments where there's less oxygen. So when the wild rice seeds fall to the substrate and in the benthos to germinate, they have to sit there for a while. And if sulfate has accumulated in there, combines with mercury, you get methylation of mercury. And that is that's a toxic to all aquatic organisms, very, very toxic. I couldn't explain it any better than that.
Thank you, Ms. Munson. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Munson, I'm a biology major. I took a little entomology, did a little work on the Schistocerca lineata, grasshoppers, and so forth. There you go. How about that, Mr. Chair? Huh?
Excellent.
We're
all very impressed.
I'm sure you are, yeah. Paddy rice versus the wild, you said they're not the same. Just in a nutshell, what's the difference?
Ms. Munson.
Mr. Chairman. Fabian, Representative Fabian. As I understand it, the paddy rice is grown in fields that are flooded with water coming from our river systems. The plant germinates when it's time to harvest the seed. The fields are drained, and the rice is harvested. Then it's replanted. There's no self-sustaining or self-perpetuation of the plant. So it's not a natural condition, and those plants that are growing in the paddies aren't interacting necessarily. Sure, there may be some ducks that discover it and fly down and eat it, but it's not a natural, functioning, healthy system, dynamic system, like the system where the wild rice naturally grows. Naturally, wild rice is growing in water that's moving. The fields of paddy rice are not moving. So you have all kinds of different interactions taking place among organisms. Some organisms, especially aquatic organisms, exist, primarily in lintic habitats where there's standing water. Others exist more primarily in lotic, flowing water habitats. Wild rice tends to be where there's water moving. So it's just not the same as a naturally functioning system.
Thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate it, Ms. Munson.
Thank you.
That's the last of the wild rice. We have forestry next. I believe someone's here from the Minnesota Forestry Association. Welcome, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Bruce Zumbalin, Chair of the Government Relations Committee with the Minnesota Forestry Association, the state's oldest conservation organization founded in 1876 to promote stewardship of Minnesota's forests. We pursue that mission through our educational activities and being an advocate for Minnesota's 194,000 family-owned woodlands with the goal of encouraging those families to retain and manage their properties in a sustainable manner. I echo the comments made earlier this morning by Don Arnosky on the value and importance of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and how well Minnesota's are being managed now, particularly private lands. Much of that work on the DNR's, family-owned woodlands has been due to the DNR's Forest Stewardship Program, carried out in partnership with private consulting foresters and soil and water conservation districts. It is a model for the rest of the country. In this state, over 11,000 Minnesota woodland owners have stewardship plans on their properties. We are concerned about the size of the budget reduction. We know that budget reductions have to be made. But we are concerned about the size of the budget reduction to the DNR's forestry division. will make it much more difficult for some landowners to obtain help in managing their woodlands in the face of rising property taxes and pressures to subdivide or develop their properties. We're also concerned, I guess we need to express our concern over the proposed closure of DNR nurseries. This testimony is awkward to me from the standpoint that the owners of two of Minnesota's largest private tree nurseries that grow conservation-grade seedlings for reforestation are longtime supporters of the Minnesota Forestry Association. It would be nice to support the proposal to close those nurseries, given most of our members' interest in private ownership and supporting the private sector, but frankly, we think the current balance of providing tree seedlings from the two private nurseries that is just fine. Those two private nurseries grow containerized planting stock, seedlings and soil plugs grown in greenhouses. The two DNR nurseries, on the other hand, produce only bare rootstock grown in outdoor beds. Both have their place in reforestation of private lands. I know you're pressed for time, Mr. Chairman, and unless there's some questions, I thank you for considering my comments.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier? Thank you. Appreciate it. Next, we're going to hear on the school trust land. Don Arnosti, you could lead it off. This is members, maybe Arnosti while you're coming, Mr. Arnosti, while you're coming down, trying to remember where that is in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, it's section 12 on page 35.
Thank you, Mr. Arnosti. I'm just going to read it if you're okay, so that members know what we're talking about. On page 35, section 12, line 21, the sentence reads, I'll read the whole, it's a long run-on sentence. The legislature intent that it is the goal of the permanent school fund to secure the maximum long-term economic return from the school trust lands consistent with the fiduciary responsibilities imposed by the trust relationship established in the Minnesota Constitution. None of that language is proposed to be deleted. The next, the rest of this sentence is proposed to be deleted in House File 1010. With sound natural resource conservation and management principles and with other specific policy provided in state law. And Mr. Arnosti, that's what you wanted to speak to. Mr. Arnosti.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your indulgence in having me up here again. I guess that comes with 23 years of experience working around the legislature. My name is Don Arnosti. I'm policy director with the Audubon Society. I personally have been involved in many of these issues and have an intimate understanding of from whence this language comes. And I'd like to remind you of some of the testimony I gave this morning with regard to the public controversy that we had about 20 years ago in this state surrounding timber harvest and the practices that were used to manage our forests. There was a series of activities that occurred, everything ranging from lawsuits to public demonstrations and other things, ultimately that was the public expressing their concern about the fact that we were not applying best science and best sustainable forest practices to the management of our public lands, whether they were trust lands or other lands. I'm focusing on forest lands at this point because the large bulk of the school trust lands are forest lands. However, some of them are found in the boundary waters. There used to be some found in the state parks. I believe those have been switched out. And there certainly are some that are exploited for mineral resources as well. But at the moment, I'm focusing on the majority of the lands which are in forest management and make up the large bulk, millions of acres of our state forest lands. They're managed for revenue for our school children. Part of what Minnesota society, I think, came to an understanding of is that we were going to modernize and apply best sciences and best practices to sustainable forest principles. We talked this morning about the creation of the Forest Resources Council, some of the forest management guidelines, which are voluntary guidelines, but which are broadly applied in both private and public lands in this state, and the development of the
system in by which certification came about. Certification is actually a private market mechanism by which buyers can express their preference for well-managed timber. Minnesota has the honor of having the largest pool of certified forest lands in North America. And these school trust lands are more than half of the state certified pool. The timber industry has repeatedly publicized and made public statements, particularly the paper industry, that this is a competitive advantage, something very important to their ability to compete for specific contracts and other provisions where the paper buyers are looking for validation that the paper supply they're buying is coming from well-managed forests. The striking of this language, which originates in 1998, it was inserted in the statute in 1998 at the end of what I would call a decade of turmoil and a lot of social turmoil, is a part of the construct that we have done in this state to bring about social acceptance of the management we have of our timberlands. And I believe that it is unwise from the standpoint of what kind of message are we sending to the public about how we're going to manage part of their lands, these trust lands, these forest trust lands, and is it consistent to have long-term fiduciary responsibilities to develop revenues for our kids at the same time as adhering to some of our long-term concerns about natural resources and other goods that we get from our public lands. I urge you not to take this step. I did have a conversation with the chair earlier about this, and he expressed to me his belief that this language is unconstitutional because it restricts, you might say, the original mandate given to be fiduciary lands for the benefit of our state's children. I took the opportunity to talk to one of the extremely experienced attorneys who works in this field on behalf of environmental organizations and an attorney in private practice who's very experienced in timber litigation and forest management issues. I won't name him here because I'm only, these are my words, not his. I asked him and I said, what is your opinion about this? Have you heard? Is this constitutional or not constitutional?
Is that my phone call, perhaps? Could be.
Yeah. Let me take that out of the way. I'll stay back.
No, you're all right.
He replied that obviously he didn't have the time and the short notice to do a full evaluation. But in his experience, nobody had ever questioned the constitutionality of this language, and this is 13 years old, as I mentioned, and it had never been raised. And the proper place to bring this up is to ask an opinion of the Attorney General, if indeed there is a question about the constitutionality of that language. I would recommend that as an appropriate course rather than striking this language, which sends a negative signal to the people of this state about how we're going to manage a large chunk of our forest land and perhaps risks the credibility and the certification that the state has achieved, which is an important competitive advantage for our timber industry. I'll end my testimony there and be happy to try to answer questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Anosti. Question? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anosti, I am thinking about if we take the language out that says sound natural resource conservation, then the implication is it's okay for unsound natural resource conservation. And what I'm thinking about mainly is invasive species here. So if we have pockets of land that can have invasive species on. And of course, that's bad for the rest of our timberlands. But then that's one of those spirals, it seems to me, that invasives gets in the rest of your timber and that just intensifies. Would you read that the same way?
Mr. Anosti.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, I would read the removal of this language to say that we're going to be doing financial-only management of our land. In other words, we're going to be thinking strictly of money and not of resources. Certainly, control of invasive species is a costly investment that we need to make and would not directly return revenue to the school trust land. So I think it is reasonable to assume that perhaps we would not make investments to control invasive species like garlic mustard or buckthorn or some of the other woodland invasive plants that we are fighting to keep under control in this state. And it would be a problem if several million acres of state forest land were no longer protected in that manner.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius. Mr. Anasthi, if I could ask, so your point there is it would be prudent in the northern part of Minnesota if it was to become invested with buckthorn that we spend school trust land money to remove the buckthorn from the school trust land on a broad landscape base?
No.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to make that statement, but I believe we have in place via the forest management site level guidelines, the landscape plans, and professional management of the Department of Natural Resources, professionals who can make the decision about where we deploy our limited resources to address invasive species. And terrestrial invasive species, whether they're insects such as the Asian ash borer, the emerald ash borer, plants such as buckthorn, garlic mustard, honeysuckle, there's a number of others. Obviously, we can't address all of them all the time, but I think it is important that that be part of the management directive to use best judgment to deploy our investments for the maximum return.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Agosti, implicit in my question was that you get better stands of timber to sell if it's not full of invasive species, and you get regeneration, which is, of course, what we all want on these lands. And invasives can keep, I mean, you and I know buckthorn probably better than we would like to know it, and buckthorn can keep regeneration from happening. So if we use practices that allow buckthorn to come in rather than practices that are currently being used that try to keep buckthorn out, we are managing the resource for a financial gain, which says to me that there is no question that this language is constitutional. I'm not worried about it.
Well, Representative McGinnis, I'm trying to understand. You just said it would make sense to control some invasive species. If it makes sense, then wouldn't it be allowed? I'm not sure I'm following you. If it makes sense, you could do it.
Well, I'm not sure. We're not communicating very well, because all I am saying, Mr. Chair, is if you manage your lands with sound natural resource conservation, you're going to have better stands of trees, and they're going to regenerate. Financially, that's a good thing. So sound natural resource conservation is sound financial management also. So that's why I don't think there's anything remotely unconstitutional with this language.
And Representative Wagenius, if I could ask, remotely unconstitutional in the language that's left or the language being removed?
In the language being removed.
Well, Representative Wagenius, I don't think it was being removed because it was worried about it being unconstitutional, not that I'm aware of. I would say the motivation for it being removed is the direction in the Constitution is that school trust land is supposed to be managed for the kids and for economic return for the kids. And I believe the language in 3521 and 3522 would lead us to manage the land not necessarily for the return for the kids for the school trust land, but instead it would direct the Department of Natural Resources to manage the natural resources for enjoyment of people that want to enjoy natural resources, if you tell the DNR to manage something with sound natural resource conservation management principles, I don't know that they're going to log it or sell it or mine it. They're going to manage it for somebody that wants to hunt in it, bird watch, pick berries, and things like that. And I don't know if that meets what the intent was of the Constitution. I think the intent of the Constitution is more in the first three lines. Representative Wagenius.
I don't think we want to debate this today, but what the testifier had said was that there was a constitutional issue here, and I was missing the constitutional issue because you're looking at, as Representative Purcell pointed out to me, on 3519, long-term economic return, and how do you get that but with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. So all I was doing was commenting on what I understood to be one of the questions here, which was a constitutional question, and I wasn't seeing it, and that's seeing any constitutional problem. So that's all I was commenting on.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arnosti, you used the word exploited when describing how the land is being used. Can you explain that for me, please?
Mr. Arnosti.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I can't recall my exact words, so if you could give me the context, I'd be happy to explain what I was thinking, but I was speaking extemporaneously.
Representative Fabian.
I believe you said they're being exploited for the financial gain.
Mr. Arnosti.
We can check the record and find out, I'm sure. But
Mr. Arnosti.
Sure. I believe what I probably was referring to was my reading of the remaining language, if the struck language was here, would direct that the lands be managed or exploited and utilized exclusively for economic returns. And I believe that it is entirely consistent with the Constitution to think long-term and not think solely of economic returns in the best interest of our children. I hasten to add I have three children that I've put through the public school system. It's not for my lack of commitment to the school system or the education of our children.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in the second sentence, it talks about maximum long-term economic gain. We've heard testimony in our committee before where there's a $1.4 billion amount of money that's out there from Mr. Vadas. He's talked about that. I think if we leave this language in that's been struck, I'm concerned. I have a concern for the fact that I think that our children in our schools are the ones that are going to become exploited. And with the language that's there, the maximum long-term economic return for schools, that satisfies any concerns that I might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Anasti, if I can ask, I respect where you're coming from, but can I ask you, what do you see happening to this land that would be things that you would call exploiting it?
Mr. Chairman, hearkening back 20 years ago, there was a lot of controversy over clear cut on short rotation for pulpwood industries. Maximum rotation cycles, disregarding best water quality standards, best management practices, which were subsequently developed to that time. We had many of these trust fund lands are actually found in the bog lands of northern Minnesota. Coochaching County has a very high percentage of these lands. And again, I'm focusing my discussion on the forested lands. I recognize there's a diversity in some other areas, but many of these bog forest lands, lowland forests, are very sensitive to disturbance. And the time of year and even weather you can get in a particular year does depend on weather and whether freeze down occurs before heavy snow happens. There's been many things that have been done in the last 20 years to develop what I like to call the Handbook of Better Forestry. It's called the Forest Resource Council's Site Level Forest Management Guidelines. That's the official title. These are voluntary, yet they've been applied by all of the public land management agencies, including the Forest Service, which does not have to abide by state-level policy guidance in this state, and they are found via surveys to be used on in excess of 80% of private lands, because most private landowners are very interested in the long-term sustainable management of their lands. These fragile boglands, forest lands, which are millions of acres of this land, are very sensitive to disturbance. If we sent in loggers at the wrong time, the wrong season, the wrong year to harvest the black spruce, the ash that's there, we will have, for example, in some of these water areas, we will actually have an increase in water level. We're worried about that with the emerald ash borer, that through the potential loss of the ash via this invasive pest, we may wind up with elevated water tables and a loss of the forest completely, just with the 6-inch rise in water, for example. There's a lot of the Handbook of Better Forestry that really is about sustaining the forest and looking out for the long term, yet it may cost more. We may not be able to harvest in certain areas because we're being protective of hydrology, we're being protective of the long-term value of the forest. So many of these lands are particularly sensitive.
Thank you, Mr. Arnasti. I'm wondering if either the DNR or Mr. Brandt is way up in the back. Either Mr. Brandt or the DNR, if I'm not mistaken, don't we have some policies in place about forest management and how we can log our forest, and sometimes we don't have the loggers come in wet times of the year and such? Does Mr. Brandt want to... you couldn't get any farther away from us and still be here. Mr. Brandt, I'm not sure if you were part of the conversation. Mr. Arnasti, I asked, he talked about, we're talking about school trust lands and the potential logging of them, and he talked about one of the things that could happen would be the exploitation of these lands, and he talked about logging them could be considered exploitation, and he talked about logging them when it was too wet or bog or the wrong time of year. Didn't we in recent years do some things about logging and sustainable forest or best management practices? Do we still log like we used to when I was a kid?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. I think as folks know, our members are primary manufacturers of forest products and renewable energy, landowners, loggers, and truckers. There are a whole host of protections that are out there, some of them Mr. Arnasti cited, that have been developed over the past 20 years. There are a number that are embodied in the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, which established the Forest Resources Council, the site level program, the landscape level program, and other activities. We have an extensive training program run by a separate nonprofit for loggers. That's the Minnesota Logger Education Program. About 95% of the wood that's harvested in the state is harvested by loggers that have completed that training. I always, and without denigrating my friends with law degrees, like to point out that we require more hours per year in training to be current in the Minnesota Logger Education Program than attorneys are required to keep their licenses. But we believe pretty deeply in the sustainable management of the forest resources. Mr. Arnasti cited the guidelines, which have been developed over the last 15 years, that set a whole host of standards. You know, in my time in this industry, I've seen an evolution, and the evolution goes back even much further, evolution in equipment. Right now, with high flotation tires on skidders and other logging equipment, cut-to-length systems, they actually exert less ground pressure on the forest floor than you or I walking through the woods do. So there's been a, an extensive evolution. There's also requirements in virtually every timber contract out there for you know, protecting the soils, not rutting and such. We had this winter, and I don't want to belabor this, we had this winter the circumstance where we had very heavy snow early in the winter. Swamps did not freeze. There is a provision in state law that allows the commissioner of the DNR to extend timber sales when those situations occur. The DNR commissioner did that. We were very grateful for that. Counties followed suit with that. So there's a whole host of protections in place if that's...
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brandt, correct?
Yes.
Are you aware of any different practices in the logging of school trust lands compared to other state lands or private lands in terms of, for example, rotation or how long a stand goes before it's cut and then replanted? Are they managed pretty much the same way?
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, and I, you know, I'll go off with my knowledge on this. You may want to ask the question directly of the DNR. It's my understanding that as the DNR develops their SFRMPs, Sustainable Forest Resource Management Plans, that the all of the lands that the DNR managed are treated essentially the, are treated the same. So there's not different rotation ages, to the best of my knowledge, used for acquired lands versus school trust fund lands.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, you sufficiently took care of my concerns with your line of questioning.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brandt, you have the bill in front of you, right?
No, I don't, but I think I recall the bulk of it.
So having looked at it, it's been out there, do you support Section 12 as it's written?
And this is the permanent school trust fund lands?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Brandt.
You know, we think that the department, and I sent an email around a number of weeks ago after Representative Dietrich's bill was heard, we think that the department has not given sufficient weight to their fiduciary responsibilities, and I didn't go into it, Mr. Chairman, with Representative Anderson's question, but frankly, we don't think it's appropriate that school trust fund lands be managed identically to the acquired and the other lands. We think that there's a higher fiduciary responsibility there for permanent school trust fund lands. We think that that can be done utilizing sound natural resource principles, but you know, we think that the department needs to get a little more direction on this topic. And so,
well, Mr. Brandt, but can we log those in an environmentally sensible way and do it? If we're not doing it now, would this direction help it? But we want to maintain the land in an environmentally sensible way.
Mr. Chairman, I think that you know, we can log those lands in an environmentally sensitive way, and we can put a little higher priority on some returns to the trust. I don't think that those are mutually exclusive objectives in any way, shape, or form. You know, there's a broad range of values and habitats and species out there that forests support. You know, we have a strength in our state of a wealth of different opportunities for management between the federal approach, the state approaches, the county approaches, and the multiple objectives of the, I don't know, 160,000 family forest owners here in the state.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Brandt, as I look at this and look at forestry, grew up on a farm and have worked in agriculture a lot all my life, and I realize that farmers have the best interest of their farmland in mind as they produce crops, plan their rotations, and apply other management principles to their land. They are exercising fiduciary responsibility on behalf of their family members. This would seem to extend in that same direction, and I'd be curious if you would believe that falling under the term fiduciary responsibility would or the term fiduciary responsibility may inherently mean providing for the long-term production and success of that particular land and whatever endeavor it it is best suited to be used with used in. Curious about whether you think that that those are parallel and whether that there is that inherent relationship.
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drozdowski, I mean, I would assume, and certainly as we look at the management of industrial lands through the years, that it would be, in a fiduciary sense, irresponsible to do unsustainable management over time. I mean, the trust fund was set up in perpetuity in the Constitution, and if we don't manage those for the long term, those lands for the long term sustainability, it would seem that you would be abrogating the responsibilities to the trust in that instance without question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brandt, thank you. I think you you made a good point. Thank you.
Representative Hand, to this point, Representative Fabian?
Well, for Mr. Brandt or somebody, well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen first. Representative Hansen. Sorry, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brandt, you've been here for a number of years, and you're very good with your words. What I heard maybe is a little different, that that you could work things with the DNR to have a higher fiduciary return and still do the good work that involves sustainable forestry practices and doing things environmentally without a statute change, that a statute change isn't really necessary if you can work with things with the DNR. Was I hearing a little wrong there or not?
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you know, maybe I'll just quote Commissioner Landwehr from last night. I mean, I think it's kind of a leading question, and I'm, you know, I think I've tried to articulate our position on sustainable forest management and our position on fiduciary responsibilities, and I've tried to be, you know, clear about that.
Representative Hansen,
then I'll make it
if
simpler.
I may, to that point, Representative Hansen, I think your point that it's the legislature that needs to give direction to DNR is the good discussion we're having now, as opposed to wondering how Mr. Brandt's going to work with the policies that the DNR imposes. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'll go back to my first question. Mr. Brandt, do you support Section 12 as it's written? That's a yes or no.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Representative Hansen, I have not had that discussion with my members in a specific way. The bill has been out there. We don't meet every, you know, 3 days or, you know, every day, if you will. You know, I can tell you that we have a very long track record supporting sustainable management. We have a long track record supporting responsible fiduciary activities on behalf of the state as well as on behalf of the trust. And I mean, it's not a simple yes/no response. I know that's what you're looking for, but I'm not in a position to give that at this point.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brandt, just one quick question, and maybe somebody else can give this answer too. What is the potential economic benefit to our students and our schools from the logging interest on the school trust land?
Mr. Brandt?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, about 40% of the state harvest comes off of school trust fund lands. We pay the state about $22 million a year on average over the last 5 years to harvest state-owned and managed timber. The school trust fund gross revenues are about $9 to $10 million a year, that 40% figure. So, I mean, it's a significant amount, you know, and we, and I, you know, tried to be clear, and in the email that I sent to the committee on Representative Dietrich's bill, pointed out a number of things that we think can be done within the context of sound natural resource, sustainable, fiduciary, responsible management that's going to get some more money for the trust, and you know, we think those should be done. I mean, do we think that every stand of school trust fund land has to be harvested at the maximum economic rotation age? No, we don't think that. We don't think that about any land. Do we think that you're exercising your fiduciary responsibilities if permanent school trust fund lands, Aspen stands, 60% of them, 70% of them in the landscape are managed to twice the rotation of 80 years? No, we don't think that's good management either. So we think that there's an opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brandt.
Thank you.
Next, I have Kevin Groschold with the Isaac Walton League. I'm sorry, Mr. Brandt, Representative Wiginius. Sorry.
I don't know whether Mr. Arnosti had finished testifying.
Mr. Arnosti, were you still on, or do you have a question for Mr. Arnosti?
No, I don't have a question for him. I just wondered if he'd finished.
Were you still going, Mr. Arnosti? I didn't realize we pushed you right out of there. Mr. Arnosti.
Mr. Chair, you didn't push me right out of there, but I would like the opportunity for just a minute to reply to Mr. or Representative Druskowski. And that is about the behavior of individuals on their privately owned land versus the behavior of individuals on public land. It's called the tragedy of the commons. It's nothing unique to our society or anything of that nature, but the inherent, and I've had a long conversation with one of the leading timber industry figures in this state about his advocacy for certain harvest levels on public lands that immediately adjoined some of his corporate private timberlands that were essentially similar, that he was managing on a very different rotation. And I asked this person, I can tell you details later, but I really, he's not here, I don't want to enter his name into the record. I asked him, how could he advocate for public land harvests at triple the rate that he was managing his own private corporate lands, which I thought were beautifully managed and were terrific in terms of wildlife, in terms of value, and he was doing it for the long term for his family. And he just kind of smiled at me and said, well, he said, if I don't get that timber, some of my competitors will. So I'm just after as much of the public timber as fast as I can. That allows me to guard my private land. That's a natural human tendency. I'm not accusing this person of anything other than behaving towards the commons in the manner that every individual does. And I think there is a dramatic difference between how a farmer treats their own farmland versus how various industries or individuals might treat our commonly owned public lands. And that is the reason why we have standards, guidelines, and foresters and others to make sure that we're managing them in a similar manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arnosti. Any other questions for Don? Thank you, Mr. Arnosti. Mr. Proschult, and I apologize if I butchered the name. He was here earlier. Maybe it was just that testimony he did earlier. Mr. Chaplin from the Nature Conservancy. Welcome, Mr. Chaplin. Good to see you again. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Chaplin. I'm a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy. As a lot of you know, the mission of the Nature Conservancy is to preserve the plants, animals, and natural communities that represent the diversity of life on Earth by protecting the lands and waters they need to survive. It's that mission that has driven me to testify against the deletion of the language and the goal of the Permanent School Fund that requires state school trust lands to be managed for sound natural resource conservation and management principles. The point I'd like to make is that the removal of sustainable forest management will have a negative impact on some of Minnesota's most important natural resources. And I'll use a couple of examples. 37% of the state's old growth forests occur on the 4.6% of the state that is school trust lands. Second item I'd mention is that at least 30% or 36% of the outstanding and high biodiversity significant lands also occurred there. If all of these lands are managed for the greatest economic returns, and what we're speaking here is short rotation forestry, it will threaten these resources and reduce the diversity and health of the state's forest. I'd also expect that we would have negative impacts on water quality in the areas. We'd have negative impacts on wildlife, carbon storage. We'd have increased forest fragmentation. All of these things, I think, can be expected. Now, unsustainable forest practices may also likely have an economic impact as well. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that the 1.7 million acres of school trust lands within the 3.9 million acres of state forests represent about 44% of all of our state forests. We are talking about a big percentage of the state's forests that we are considering removing from conservation management. Now, if this happens, school trust lands will almost certainly lose their sustainable forest certification, and it could threaten the overall certification of all of the state timberlands, state timberlands as well. You know, one of the things, of course, is that certified wood products bring a premium in today's market, and it's pretty unclear as to what the market would be for the uncertified wood. Now, for both ecological and economic reasons, it's important to continue to manage all of Minnesota's state forest lands with sound natural resources conservation and management principles. What we would contend is that it is not a conflict to manage lands in a sustainable manner while acting prudently to balance short and long-term interests of current and future school trust fund beneficiaries. With that, I'll end, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to take them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Chaplin? Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chaplin, could you repeat that first statistic you gave again? I didn't catch the first number.
Mr. Chaplin.
Yes, Mr. Chair. 37% of the state's old growth forests occur on the 4.6% of the state that is school trust land. In other words, school trust lands make up 4.6% of the state, and they have 37% of the state's old growth forests.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Canute? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chaplin.
Thank you.
I think that does our testimony, members. I just was going to lay out Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to ask if you could ask if anybody wanted to testify on the public utility fund transfers. I talked with someone late in the day that wasn't aware, and I don't know if anybody does, but, you know, we've been mostly on the DNR. We had somebody from the realtors last night, but just to give the opportunity, Mr. Chair, if that would be okay.
That's a good idea. Is there anybody that wants to speak to anything? Representative Hansen just mentioned specifically there's some Department of Commerce, there's some fund transfers, different things in the bill. Anybody in the audience to speak for or against any provisions in the bill? Our intention tomorrow is to move right into amendments. Which, thank you, Representative Hansen. Members, I think Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just a question. The thread of discussion we were just having about the school trust lands, are there other sections in the bill other than the one we were talking about? I'm curious. I know Representative Dietrich is working on this whole notion of having a group of what's the term we're looking for here? Fund managers to manage this. Would it make sense for them to be the ones to be to be the group that we actually? It would make sense that they're the ones that are making these judgments around the sustainability of the land as it goes forward in the management and holding the loggers and miners and other people accountable. And I'm wondering, is there room for additional language to accommodate that if that's the way we'd want to go?
Representative Drazkowski, if you remember, and members, when Representative Dietrich came in, I can't remember what bill she followed, but originally we had hoped for her to have rather lengthy testimony, and she ended up getting a very short amount of testimony, and we've never had her back again. I think she believes she had three specific bills, actually, three different bills. I believe we're going to probably get a chance to look at that issue again with Representative Dietrich. She's got House File 435, maybe a bill that would set up an individual at the Department of, well, actually, her original thoughts were that it would be a separate outside the Department of DNR. I think she's now looking at a model that there would be a person within potentially the agency of the DNR that would report to a board of directors, I believe is what they're calling it.
Trustees, she used.
Trustees. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And that would then give some separate direction to the management of these lands. I think our movement here, Representative Drazkowski, is a very small movement, Representative, along some of the lines that Representative Dietrich has talked about. And this is a tough issue, but one that I think we have to lay out what is the intention of the management of the school trust lands. And then, you know, Representative Drazkowski, there is some language in our bill that deals with asking the DNR. There's, I believe, $200,000 in our bill that asks the DNR to come back with a plan for managing lands in counties where the ownership is greater than 50%, or public ownership is greater than 50%, it's in the back of the bill. That would be, you could say that relates to school trust, because I believe most of those counties, Representative Dill, that have that large percentage, lots of time it's either school trust or ConCon land that puts it over the top on that. So that could be an item, I believe, that school trust, and particularly, I just thought of, I bet Ms. Taylor, did we ever get an amendment about that St. Mary's Lake? Do we have that? Wow. Okay. That was those 8 lots on St. Mary's Lake. Where I guess we're not ready for that yet. That may come later on in the lands bill or something, but usually we've kept controversial items out of that. I didn't know that we didn't have that, but that's not there. Is that anyway, that's where we are at, and I understand now discussions with DNR, actually my thoughts on those lots on St. Mary's, they actually have that authority currently. They didn't need it. I remember now Ms. Rudolph just mentioned to me that that was unnecessary language when we talked about that. So I think, Representative Drazkowski, that language that you were important on getting in the back of that bill about moving the DNR forward on the land issue is in the back there that will help a lot. Members, there's a number of, and to the audience, the amendments are posted on the website, currently on the House website on our homepage for the committee. I believe there's 2 amendments that Ms. Taylor is still working on tonight. One of them, 3 actually, thank you, Ms. Rudolph. I think Representative Hansen has one that's still being drafted, and I have at least one, and maybe do I have both of them? One of them does a couple more, and Representative Dill has one. So, Ms. Taylor, you may be there all night, but you're going to get an earlier start than we thought. So, for the most part, I think we're actually doing pretty well on the 24-hour. It's our intention to work on them tomorrow. If any members are not comfortable with any of the amendments because they feel we should have more time to look at them, what we don't get done tomorrow morning, we can come back in the evening and take up those amendments if we feel that's necessary. Questions? Well, this is pretty great. We're going to call it an evening. Hold on. Oh, we've got the minutes of yesterday, the 21st. Representative Hilty, do you want to move the minutes of March 21st?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Yep. Members, we're adjourned. Time for dinner.